House care to order for this 15th day of the month, and welcome two new members to the committee. Can I ask you guys introduce yourself?
Good morning. I'm Andrea Salinas. I'm the representative from House District 38, which is Southwest Portland and Lake Oswego.
And I'm Representative Rich Vile, House District 26, Sherwood, Shoals, Wilsonville, South Hillsborough. And I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Well, welcome. It's great to have new blood and to have more people to try and keep under control. I'll do the best I can. Dr. Droppers, I'm going to open an informational hearing, and would you call the first panel, please?
Chair Greenlick, Pat Allen, Public Affairs Director.
Morning, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee.
Are you flying solo today?
I'm flying solo today.
Wow.
Until the
wow.
End.
Wow.
Patrick Allen, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Before I start, I just have to chuckle a bit with Representative Vile. He and I met about a month ago. I'm living in Sherwood. I'm his constituent, and we had a little get acquainted and talked about the fact that we would never see each other again in the course of business because he wasn't on any committees that had anything to do with him. Not a week later, I think.
Right.
I think he was appointed to this committee. So. Today I'd like to talk about a variety of issues that you have called out on your agenda, basically an update on leadership and management assessment issues that are going on at the agency. We'll take some time to give you a further update about redeterminations. This is the 115,000 people who the agency was working on over the summer to determine their eligibility. We'll talk about the overpayment issue that cropped up in the media in the last couple of weeks and give you some more detailed explanation of what's going on in that situation. I've got a CHIP update, such as it is, with the federal funding situation. In the interests of efficiency, I'd like to hoist up from lower in the agenda a quick update on the state hospital administrator recruitment. And then at the very end, I'll invite Lillian Shirley up, the director of the Public Health Division, to give an update on public health modernization, and that should probably fill our time pretty adequately. So let me start with management update. I think I gave you in September an idea of some of the initial changes that I've made in the agency to do some structuring around separating the chief financial officer, chief operating officer function, those kinds of things. There's really nothing new there. As I reported to you at that time, we've engaged in about a 90-day review of the organizational structure to try to determine if we're organized in the most effective way to be able to do business. We're coming to the end of that 90 days. Our plan is to identify a draft of any structural changes, roll those out first to our employees and then broadly to our stakeholders, and basically ask the question, does this make sense to you all who either do the work or engage with us in having the work done, go through that stakeholder process and be able to announce whatever changes we're going to make in December and make them effective in January. The real objective in all of that, aside from getting us the right organizational structure, is to make sure that we put employees through a change like that one time and not do a series of changes and leave people in kind of in an in-between state for an extended period of time, because that tends to be hard on employees.
And you do remember that the Health Policy Board has a piece of the
correct, and they're part of the discussion that we'll have in that process, right? The bigger issue to talk about, I think, is some of the challenges that we're running across as we dig into the agency. The $74 million overpayment issue that I'll talk about in more detail later is one of them. There are others that have cropped up. Last week, an employee brought me a sheaf of papers explaining a problem that I barely understand as I sit here today, having to do with what happens if two people who are very similar enroll more or less at the same time in the Oregon Health Plan, and that there may be some problems around that. Accounting staff that is shared service staff from Department of Human Services has shared a list of concerns they have about business operations, and we're beginning to dig into those. I think 2.5 months in, what I'm beginning to get a strong sense of is that OHA, in many respects, has functioned a lot like a startup. It's still a relatively young agency, and it's been in that startup phase of getting some really cool things done, enrolling 400,000 people on the Oregon Health Plan despite a failed platform, driving down health care costs over the last 5 years, about $1.3 billion from what they otherwise would have done. But like a startup, it's maybe coming to that phase where the shareholders bring in a CEO and you begin to add some business rigor to the operation, and that's really the kinds of those are the kinds of issues that that are coming up now are stem from that lack of business rigor, and that's really the focus that I and my team are moving to and really working on. These problems that I've outlined will report to you in more detail once we understand them better. They certainly in and of themselves they're not huge dollar amounts that are budget busters, particularly when you boil them down to their state funding component. But they're indicative of that lack of business rigor or those issues around business rigor that that we want to try to address. The other thing I want to comment on about that is I'm today, and actually raised these in Senate Healthcare on Monday, telling you about things before I even really have any idea of what they are or what their size is or what their nature is. I have to share that's actually really uncomfortable for me. What I'm used to in my previous agency is identifying some kind of an issue and really understanding it, thoroughly vetting it out, being able to describe it, if it's a problem, understand what happened and why and whether it's been fixed, and be able to accurately give you an assessment of what it is before I talk about it. Well, I understand now the nature of the difference in the spotlight, I think, better than I appreciated before after this overpayment issue. And that if I'm waiting to figure all that stuff out before I talk to the governor, talk to you, or talk to the media, it can look like we're trying to hide information that we're absolutely profoundly not trying to do. And so I'm going to start erring on the side of telling you things before I really understand them so that you know that they're there, with hopefully the understanding from you that I'm going to come back and my story may change, may take some time to get to dollar amounts. And I may come back and say, you know, that first thing I told you about turns out it's nothing. And I'll be able to document why I think it's nothing. But I want to err on the side of providing information as quickly as we can on these issues so that there's not an appearance of trying to keep information quiet. The last thing I want to touch on just in the leadership update portion of the presentation is there's a saying you hear a lot that makes me a little bit crazy, which is don't bring me a problem without bringing me a solution. Culturally, what we're really trying to do in the organization is reflect on the fact that my job is to get the problems that don't have a solution. I need people to bring me problems that if they know what the solution is, they should just solve it, and not spend time bringing it to me. My job and the job of my management team is to be the catchers for the things that people can't figure out how to solve. And so what we're really trying to do is encourage a culture of trust in being willing to do that. This will sound maybe silly, one mechanism I've set up to try to encourage that kind of communication is office hours. Kind of like when you were in college and your professors would have stated office hours and you could drop by without having an appointment. I have an open door policy. Everyone does anymore. But if you try to schedule an appointment with me, it's insane, which functionally means if you can't get on my calendar for 6 weeks, I don't actually have an open door policy. And so once a week at our main locations here in Salem and in Portland, and a little bit less frequently at other locations we have, I try to block out an hour and a half or 2 hours of time where people can just drop by. And this issue that I raised about people who are similar enrolling in the health plan came to me with someone coming during office hours and wanting to bring this issue. And so what we're trying to do is find ways to encourage that kind of communication so that we can become aware of concerns that employees have and problems that we need to work on. Like any organization, we're going to get a fair amount of stuff it's important to that employee, but it's not really a thing from an organizational standpoint, and that's totally fine. But that's the way we'll be able, I think, to excavate those other issues. Before I move on to redeterminations, maybe I should stop there and see if anyone has questions.
Go on, Pat.
So redeterminations, this is the issue of the 115,000 people who there was a backlog that the agency worked through the end of August at the governor's direction to complete their determinations, which was done. We reported numbers to you in September alleged days. The important takeaway is we talked about the fact that there were two kinds of people whose membership in the Oregon Health Plan was revoked. Those who went through redetermination and it was determined that they were no longer eligible. The other pile, though, were people who didn't respond to our request to go through redetermination. And we explained that there's a 90-day retroactivity where someone can turn up and in fact, then redetermine after they've been taken off the plan and they've got up to 90 days to be found eligible and get put back on the plan. Typically the scenario is they ignore their mail and don't respond, and they show up at a service provider to receive services, and the service provider tells them that they're no longer on the OHP, and that triggers them coming back to us. About 15% of those whose eligibility was terminated due to non-response have since, as of late October, been found to be eligible. So it's about 8,000 people that we've added back to the rolls. We expect that process to continue, and in January alleged days, we'll be able to provide you a final number of what the end results of eligibility were on that process. Questions about redeterminations?
They come back after the 90 days. They start over. They're new.
Yeah, they can be found to be eligible at that point, but they don't have the retroactivity that causes them to have been covered in the intervening time. Okay, the overpayment issue. This is the issue that was reported in the press a couple of weeks ago about $74 million in overpayments, characterized as overpayments to coordinated care organizations. So this is the issue of trying to get to the bottom of something and sort of having it reported in real time. The reports were accurate based on a document released as a public record from the agency, I believe from 2016, that talked about $74 million, talked about $10 million of recoveries for 1 year. Both of those numbers are almost certainly inaccurate. They were as accurate as could be known at the time by the writer of the document when it was generated, but as we're trying to reconcile that, we now know that those numbers are both different. They're not order of magnitude different, but they will be different numbers. But I want to talk about what goes into that number because it helps illustrate why these problems are so complex and why they seem to take an inordinate amount of time to get to the bottom of. That $74 million number, whatever it comes to be, is made up of really two components. The first component is this dual eligibles issue where someone is eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. And when they're eligible for both, Medicare is the first payer and Medicaid is the second payer. We have a capitation rate that we pay to CCOs, and just a made-up number to illustrate the point, let's say it's $500 a month that a CCO gets per member. If that member is dually eligible, Medicare is going to pay some large portion of their expenses, so let's say it becomes $200 a month as a capitation payment. The difference, $300 a month, would be what we would need to recover from CCOs that were paid too much capitation. That's part of the whatever the total number ultimately is that we're looking at. The other part, however, is the fact that we submitted these expenses to CMS based on them being in the ACA expansion population at 100% match when they weren't all expansion population. They were some mix of expansion and other populations. Other populations have a variety of match rates that are not 100%. They're lower, as low as in the 60s, if not lower. And so there's a gap that we owe the federal government for too much match that was claimed that has nothing at all to do with the CCOs, and that's just our obligation back to the federal government. The third complication is that some substantial number of these people actually got their health care from their CCO, and that means that in those cases, it's actually Medicare that owes us money. And so there's kind of a triple netting effect going on here, and that's what we're working on reconciling right now. I had hoped to be able to be here today with a reconciled number. We're not quite there yet, and this is a case where I don't want to say a number until I absolutely know that that's the right number, because I don't want to come back here in January and tell you, well, it turns out that wasn't quite the number. So I'm not going to tell you a number until I know that's what it is. But that's the nature of what that challenge is. The governor has directed us to recover funds from CCOs, and so there's two components to that. The first is the reconciliation that I talked about. Because of those other offsetting factors, the match rate issue and the Medicare issue, it's not the full amount, it's some smaller amount. And the other thing that we have an obligation to do is to go through the record and make sure we don't have something that is some actual agreement based in law and rule that that CCOs should have been able to rely on to not be obligated to return those funds. I don't think that's there, but I need the reasonable due diligence is for us to go ahead and do that step. So that's in a nutshell the overpayment issue, and again it's there's some detail about it as it stands, but it also gives you some sense of the complexity and the challenges in trying to reconcile these issues as we find them, to get to the bottom of what are we looking at and what's the problem and how was it caused and has it been fixed and all those kinds of things. Might be a good spot to stop for questions.
Let me start the question.
Sure.
A simple question. My understanding is I'm the dual eligible. They would be eligible for all the service they're eligible for, but some of it would be paid by Medicare, some of it would be paid for Medicaid.
Uh-huh.
Under the Medicaid guys, in this case, we paid the CCOs the full amount, the Medicare and the Medicaid, and they provided service.
Uh-huh. Well,
they may or may not have. But they may have provided service for the full uh-huh. amount. And then the question is, they were paid the right amount, but they were paid by the wrong people or partly by the wrong people. That's not their problem, right? The problem is if they got a capitation rate and they didn't provide the Medicare, what would be normally Medicare-covered services.
I think it's simpler than that. I think it's that they got the wrong capitation rate. That in some of those cases where they got the wrong capitation rate, they provided services that should have been paid by Medicare. Even more commonly, we did it on Open Card, where we didn't have them categorized as dual eligible and paid all of their services on Open Card. And in those cases, Medicare owes us money. But the primary issue from a CCO perspective is that they got the wrong capitation rate.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So I want to step back. One step. I wasn't sure when we were going to get to ask questions here. Going back to the retroactivity of the 8,000 members, and this is a standing question that I've had for months with your predecessor that I'm waiting on a response. And we've talked about it, but just for the record, I'm trying to get a feel for what is that cash flow. And what I mean by that is if 8,000 patients now are determined to be eligible retroactively,
uh-huh.
And let's just say, for example, they do that on day 90. So for the last 3 months, does the CCO receive a capitated check for that patient, which clearly they didn't provide any services for that patient because they were in limbo, right? Or do they go automatically into fee-for-service? And if they go into fee-for-service, is that just a net neutral cash flow? Because under fee-for-service, it's actually kind of a bill to the federal government, I'm assuming, and then they eventually reconcile that and pay that back. But I've never really gotten a direct answer of how that cash flow works. So again, we've talked about it privately. I know you're working on it, but
yeah, you're not going to get that answer today either.
But that's fine.
But we're going to work.
But
on that.
Generally, who gets paid retroactively?
Well, I hate to speculate. My speculation is it's the provider that is sitting there that has been that has provided treatment and is aware of the retroactive period. But I won't really want to pin down an operational answer for you and share it with the committee of exactly how that process works, and we'll do that quickly.
Okay.
The other thing I should comment on in response to a question from Representative Bueller last Ledge Days, we've worked on trying to quantify the question of how much health care was spent on this redetermination population And we've got a letter that we can share with the committee that that tries to spell that out. We don't try to come up with a total dollar amount for the simple reason that it's impossible to say, had we accurately put someone through redetermination 9 months ago, what would the answer have been 9 months ago? So what we do is we express it in a monthly cost term. And you'll need to look at that monthly cost term and decide what you think it implies in terms of other issues. But there's just not enough information to be able to say, had we done 115,000 people 6 months earlier, what would the answer have been, and would they have been eligible or not, and thus what would the cost have been? And we'll share that document with the committee.
Representative Vile,
I apologize to the committee, Mr. Chair, for my naivete, but until a few days ago, the only thing I knew was that Medicare was old and Medicaid was poor, and I'm learning even.
That's pretty close.
Well, you can be old and poor.
And that's what I'm learning today, that it could be both. And I'm hearing that Medicaid is paid in a capitation to the CCO. Is that correct?
Yes. Chair Greenlick, Representative Vile, that's right.
And how about Medicare? How is that paid?
We don't
got a reimbursement, or excuse me for interrupting.
Yeah, no, we don't administer Medicare, so I'm less conversant on it. But that's a complex system that involves Medicare Advantage plans, which are administered through insurers or direct payment through through Social Security Administration. And I don't know whether the insurance component of that on Advantage is a capitation payment or not. We aren't involved in administering that.
Well, that kind of answers my question, which is goes to whether your agency really has the ability to fully understand what is being paid and when and how in evaluating whether somebody's been double paid.
That's more complicated.
That's
because historically, for poor elderly people, the state paid the Part B premium to keep them in Medicare. And then you get into the question of the wraparound of Medicare Advantage. It's really a very arcane.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, that's kind of where my thinking was going, is this feels like a pretty complex problem in terms of wrapping our head around where the money's going and whether we can accurately account for correct levels being paid out.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Vile, you hit on the head one of the big issues that I determined fairly early on that was a knowledge gap. For me personally, and a little bit for the agency, and we've got a critical vacancy right now in the chief medical officer position, and it's become clear to me as we work to recruit that position that partly that's a medical advice kind of a position, but partly it's also a understanding the business operation of providing healthcare services and having the agency have some base of knowledge of how all those pieces come together when they intersect in the business and art of the practice of medicine. And so as we go to recruit that chief medical officer position, that's a piece that I'm actively looking for to have a better understanding in the agency of.
Maybe Representative Bueller could apply for this job if he's out of a job next year.
I plan to have a job, yeah. and it will take care of these problems next year. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. It's a rowdy crowd today. Pat, I'm a little puzzled that you don't know the overpayment number when it's been reported that $10 million has already been refunded to CMS.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, back to my comment earlier about my druthers would be to not talk about numbers until I actually know the numbers. This was a public record generated in 2016 that I was believed to be accurate at the time based on what was known at the time. And I would say that we are more thoroughly reconciling that now and have a better understanding of the nature of the problem and are pinning that number down better. And the results will be close to those results, but they will be different.
Yeah, go ahead. So who made that decision and who knew about that?
Well, there wasn't really a decision made. There was a document generated that's I believe it's it's not like a memo with a from and to. It's just simply a document that outlines it, and I don't directly know the source of that document.
Can you get those documents?
We can try to see if that's available. Yeah.
Was it common practice for the Oregon Health Authority to refund millions of dollars to the federal government without notifying superiors, the governor's office?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that there is a common reconciliation process that goes on back and forth between the CCOs, the health authority, and CMS on reconciling facts or reconciling payments to facts after they become known. An example, and this got a little bit of play in the story in the media, people die, and you don't learn that they die immediately. You learn that they die some period of time after, and if you've had elderly relatives, you know they might receive a Social Security check or two, and that you then get a letter from Social Security asking for that money back. Well, that sort of thing and things like it happen in this world all the time, and there is a reconciliation process that involves flow of funds back and forth amongst the three entities regularly.
My question's a little more basic, Mr. Chair. Dr. Allen, when do you think you're going to be able to sort of put all this in a little bow and explain to us what happened?
First and never.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Nose, a little bit of both. Our intent is to work as hard as we can to identify as much as we can in time to bring you we'll certainly bring you a comprehensive report about what we know in the short session. We have now established an internal problem resolution process where we're going to keep a log of these issues. We're standing up a project team to work them and a management team to oversee that. That means we're going to have a log that has raw problems that haven't been scoped and thoroughly identified and vetted, and I expect the public records request to be coming in now for that document. And so we're going to have a lot of stuff out there that's unvetted, that'll look like, I don't know what it'll look like, and we're going to methodically work through those problems. I can't say that in February we're going to have figured out everything. We're going to give our best effort to be able to be as comprehensive in February as we can.
Okay, move on.
CHIP funding, Children's Health Insurance.
I have a few more questions. We're just going to let this go.
I'll give you two more. We really have a big agenda today. We have to move on.
Okay. But how long was, if this is just purely a reconciled problem, how come it was going on in 2014, 2015, 2016?
Partly, I don't know the answer to that, not having been directly involved in the work at the time. We know that the problem was identified in 2014. We've got documentation of a request to make a change in the one system to fix this categorization problem. So we know it had been identified at that point. We don't have any documentation that we found yet to figure out how was it found in 2014, who found it, anything like that. And we've not completed a review of documentation to figure out what was the decision-making process around that. We're working to do that, and we expect to be able to report back on that.
Is the IT infrastructure, the legacy of Cover Oregon, adequate to deal with these problems, or are we going to have ongoing difficulties with such redetermination, overpayment, et cetera?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, there are or have been three key components to the IT infrastructure for this. The Cover Oregon system, which was made up of the failed customer-facing platform that was never deployed, and the functional but poorly designed back-end system that was used enrollment database, the MMIS, Medicare Management Information System, MMIS system, which is an older vendor-operated system that has got issues and is due for replacement. and then the one system. And I think I listed those in reverse order of their reliability. I think that the one system, while not perfect, is performing the determination function in the way that it was designed to, and as a system is not generating new challenges. I think there are challenges that remain in the MMIS system, partly because of the system and partly because of the data that has gone into the system from the Cover Oregon platform. And I think that area is where there is still potential for us to find new problems that there's not a really a good way to surface them, because the nature of the problem is the poor quality of the database that the Oracle system generated. So there's not like a query you can say of give us all the bad information. You find it when there's some other thing that happens that causes you to run across it. I think like a lot of
things.
But you
do annual redeterminations.
We'll do redeterminations, scrub. Right. So those kinds of problems I think we'll have. But I think there are other opportunities for errors. Like anything else, that'll be a curve that starts high and goes low over time. But I don't want to try to tell you that we're in the clear now and everything is completely fine. I think we're still going to find things.
Okay. Let's move on, Pat.
Okay, let's move on to Children's Health Insurance Program. This is a federally funded program that essentially provides an enhanced match rate for kids on Medicaid. Congress was due to renew the funding for CHIP before September 30th, which they failed to do. By all accounts, this is an utterly non-controversial issue. Nobody is opposed to funding CHIP in Washington. There's all kinds of politics around, well, you know, when you do it, can you attach other stuff to it that's unrelated to CHIP, and, you know, what does that do? And, I mean, there are a million different permutations of that I won't bore you with. The bottom line is that Oregon will run out of money to operate the CHIP program in December. In the month of December, we'll have enough money to pay a portion but not all of the capitations due to CCOs for that month. A path to follow would be to begin the process right now of generating notices about December 1st or so telling parents that their children's health insurance will end effective January 1st. The governor has directed us not to do that. We have made a huge amount of progress getting kids covered in Oregon. Something like 98% of all children have health insurance, and we're getting ready to roll out Cover All Kids and hopefully bump that number even further. And she's adamant that we not lose that progress, especially since we think Congress will, in fact, turn around and fund it. And it would be terrible to go through the process of causing people to think their kids are losing their health insurance and then turn around 2 weeks later and say, never mind. We think that it'll cause confusion and that people will drop coverage and we'll end up rolling that number back. So she's asked us to look at our cash flow and figure out if, and I think there are ways that we can maintain the program at least through sometime in the spring to allow one of two things, certainly enough time for Congress to do what it should do and authorize the funding, or in the alternative for you to have come back in February and know that they haven't and be able to wrestle with what the implications of that are. I expect to provide her some analysis and options later this week and we'll go forward. But our expectation and our clear guidance from her right now is that we are not preparing to send discontinuation notices for that population.
Well, how much would we be floating on that?
I think I have a number. I think our, well, so it depends on what happens. If Congress doesn't authorize the program and we're actually out the money, and let's say we ran it through about April, this is partly the analysis we're doing right now, but it's probably low tens of millions of state funds, 10 or 20, perhaps $30 million through something like April. We need to complete that analysis and provide that number. But, of course, I mean, everybody says, and we take them at their word, that this is not – that they're going to renew the program. And they, when they do that sort of thing, they do it on a retroactive basis. And so we'll end up not out. It'll be spending general fund first and then recouping it later in the biennium.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Is there any internal discussions about the funds potentially recoup the $74 million or whatever it is, being offset for CHIP?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, we haven't explicitly looked at that, largely because when you look at the $74 million number and get it down to what its real number is, and then wash out what is reimbursable, and then of the reimbursements, what is due back to the feds, the general fund impact is actually very, very small. Certainly, if we need to put together a funding package, it would be something that we could put on the table. But it, as I understand the numbers today, and we're going to get you final numbers shortly, it wouldn't be a meaningful dent in that.
Okay. So you're not looking at offsetting those two?
Well, right now we're expecting Congress is going to fund the program. I think that conversation will be more appropriate if we roll into February and they still haven't acted, or it's clear that they're not ever going to act. And then I think we need to have a more serious analysis about, well, how do we pay for children's health insurance going forward?
Okay. Keep going.
Okay. The last thing I have before I ask Lillian and Shirley to join me is an update on the state hospital administrator recruitment. This is a very long-standing vacancy that's a critical component of not only the management team for the agency, but our meeting our obligations under the Oregon Performance Plan with the U.S. Department of Justice. We have had a couple of failed recruitments for that position. At the risk of sounding self-important, I think not having a permanent director at the agency was kind of one of the barriers in the last go-around. And so we're hoping, we're expecting to restart that recruitment shortly. We're also working with Department of Administrative Services to look at a couple of elements of how we do that recruitment to see if we can't improve the work that we do. An example, the stated pay range for that position is well below what market is for a hospital administrator. Almost universally, the resolution to that is you take the stated pay range and you provide a pay line exception that provides a net effective pay that's more reasonable. I think historically we tend to advertise the stated pay range, and you have to be enough of an insider to know how that pay line exception system works. We think it's probably more effective to go out there with what the pay line exception pay would be to make it clearer to a broader audience of what the real compensation is. We're looking a little bit also at, and again, this sounds silly, but I think it's potentially meaningful. Right now it's called the superintendent of the state hospital as opposed to the administrator of the state hospital. What's the professional universe that you look at when you use those kinds of terms, and, you know, in an automated world of people searching for jobs? And so we expect to do some of those kinds of things at the margins and then make a full court press to try to identify an administrator by the first of the year.
You know, I'm on the advisory board of the state hospital, and I've been very concerned with this issue. And I think the superintendent thing is weird. I've tried to get anybody to tell me where the term superintendent came from.
It comes from corrections. In the state classification system, this is administration
here,
of an institution.
It came from the military, I think, originally.
In state classification, it's managing a residential institution, and so we call that a superintendent, whether you're the superintendent of the Snake River Correctional Facility or the superintendent of the state hospital.
Except in the state hospital, we now have an acting administrator rather than an acting superintendent. So,
right.
I mean, it's obviously the issue in my mind is that we've been focusing too narrowly, I think, on people with state hospital experience rather than looking at the larger. There are a lot of good hospital administrators out there that we should be looking at.
I agree.
I hope you work very fast on this one, Pat. Representative Buehler?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'm going to push back a little bit, Pat. You made the analogy that Oregon Health Authority is a startup organization, but it's really almost 9 years old, right? So that's a lot older than a startup. But more concerning to me is that over the last 5 years, there's been two previous, you're the third, you know, director of this agency. In my experience, when you have continued turnover of such an important position, that's a hard job. What do you think has been the reason for the lack of success of your predecessors in running the Oregon Health Authority? And what are you going to do to correct it?
Well, Chair Greenlick, like Representative Buehler, I guess I'll push back on your pushback and say that I think the health authority has been incredibly successful in achieving its core mission and accomplishing the things it has been tasked to accomplish around around getting people covered, getting access to the health plan, driving down health care costs. Again, $1.3 billion over the last 5 years through the coordinated care system, a sustainable growth rate under 3.4% over the entire span of the Affordable Care Act. The reason I use the startup analogy is again, you get to a place where the shareholders decide they want to bring in a CEO who's going to establish some structure around the people who are out being visionary and creating wonderful new things. And that feels to me where we're at right now is I don't hold myself out as a healthcare policy visionary by any means. I know a thing or two, but I'm not going to be the guy who's going to suggest why don't we slice the bread before we sell it, right? My job is to work on establishing a structure that provides business-like rigor around the business that we do, so that we can answer the kinds of questions that I'm frustrated that we can't answer right now that seem really basic, but are really around that business structure. What I've tried to do is bring in a team of people with extensive, successful track records running large state agencies, because that's a skill set. That's a thing that's different than running a big private organization, running a small private organization, running a small state agency. And I think that that's a set of skills that the agency needs right now and that we're trying to focus on so that we can, again, improve that structure that the really smart people who are driving really good healthcare policy in Oregon need to be able to be successful and accountable to the public.
Yeah, listen, we've got about 10 minutes to finish here.
Okay, in that case, I'll ask Lillian Shirley to join me, the administrator of the Public Health Division, to talk about modernization, and I'll drive the PowerPoint.
I'm going to have to talk fast, 10 minutes.
You got about 6 minutes. You can do it.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Lillian Shirley, the director of the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to talk about public health modernization. I'm going to do it in three parts. I thank you for this opportunity. We've been doing a lot of work since the legislature sent us on this task. First, I'm going to review what we have accomplished, including the general fund investment made by the legislature in the public health modernization for the 2017-19 biennium. And then I'll review our priorities as submitted to the legislature December 16th and discuss what we would like to tackle as the public health system in 2019-21. So you've probably seen this before. This is our public health modernization framework. We know that 80% of what shapes our health and the health of our Oregonians happens outside the doctor's office, and public health promotes that health for all people in Oregon by protecting people from communicable diseases, preparing for and responding to emergencies, limiting environmental risks to human health, promoting health, and countering the impact of disease and injury, and ensure equitable access to health care. Quickly, this frame is just to remind people we started this journey in 2013. We've been working with local communities, local public health authorities since then to create a public health system that does ensure that we can reach these goals. We've learned through the assessment of state and county capabilities to meet the requirements of the public health that we conducted in 2016 that there are significant gaps, and we were able to quantify those. House Bill 2310 passed in the 2017 legislative session, and gave the Public Health Division $5 million as an initial investment to begin modernizing this work across the state based on these foundational capabilities. So these are our primary objectives. We set out to do this work. We wanted to support changes in public health infrastructure to make sure that we were doing things more efficiently and get more effective results. In September of 2017, the Public Health Division released a request for proposals for local public health authorities to implement regional communicable disease control programs. So one of the major changes that you'll see here is local public health authorities were required to work with at least one other local public health authority and prioritize communicable disease control as the first stage based on their own local epidemiology. Proposals were due in October, and they have just been awarded. So over the next 18 months, we'll be looking to implement that. This is a look at where the funds will be directed to support 30 of the 34 local public health authorities. Two local public health authorities will be offered support through the Eastern Oregon region, and applicants were encouraged, and many did, to include federally recognized tribes and their regional health equity coalitions in their proposals. And here's just a quick look. I have more detail if you would like to know who's doing what in those areas, but it just shows you how the counties and the community self-selected to do their work together. And it says that the asterisk denotes the fiscal agent, but that's not true. It's the bold county that is the fiscal agent for the surrounding areas.
Well, it would be nice if you briefed the representative and the senators that represent those districts about what's going on. I think that would be very helpful.
Yeah,
we can do that.
Yeah. Okay. So next, I just want to point out, in June of 2017, the Public Health Advisory Board, which is a governor-appointed subcommittee of the Oregon Health Policy Board, selected 8 health outcome measures for the public health system. This is the first time we've had those kind of really across-the-system measures that everyone has to report on it. These measures will be tracked and reported on publicly, similar to the CCO metrics for the Medicaid services in the Oregon Health Authority. And our initial baseline public health metrics report will be released in the first quarter of 2018. We've also been working to develop process measures because we know that we need to align them with each of the health outcomes that we're looking to achieve. And these process measures will be incorporated into our upcoming update to local public health authority contracts so that we're directing existing funds as well as new investments into achieving these outcomes.
Just a really quick question. Can you go back to the slide? Lillian, can you explain what active transportation is? I think I understand the rest of the standards, but I'm not sure what that means.
Sure. Active transportation is we're working with both county and state Department of Transportation to identify things like walking to school routes, bike lanes, et cetera. It's going to be different in different parts of the state, whether there's rural areas or urban areas with infrastructure. But again, that's why it's really important to have the local communities decide what exactly are the process measures to meet those goals.
Question.
Okay, where are we here? Okay. So just to refresh how we're going ahead and the programmatic gaps in the current...
Kenny Geyer, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, are you breaking down that data by race?
Where we have data that comes in that way, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
President Buer?
Yeah. Also about your accountability metrics, I'm surprised to not see any behavioral health or suicide metrics since both are such a problem in the state of Oregon.
So two answers to that, I mean, two pieces to that. Very important. It's reflected in our state health improvement plan and the Oregon Action Plan for Health. These are specifically things through the first round of the investment that people looked at how to prioritize to drive change across the public health specific system, things that are responsibilities of local and state governmental public health.
You don't think suicide prevention is one of those?
Well, we definitely track it. We definitely work with our partners, yes. But it's not part of our infrastructure or communicable disease. And the infrastructure and the communicable disease areas were the two we decided to focus on. With the communities and the FAB, looking at what can we demonstrate first and what is something that is totally within the realm of public health.
The FAB's the Public Health Advisory Board.
Correct, sorry. Public Health Advisory Board. But these are not weighted, you know, in terms of one worse than the other or more important than the other. These are kind of looking at how we're trying to drive system change here and where are opportunities in a sequential way to invest so that we can drive real system change across the public health scope.
I think you're missing a wonderful opportunity to impact, you know, one of the, you know, largest cause of death in the state, suicide, which I think is completely preventable and in within the realm of public health.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, I'd be glad to talk offline. We're doing a ton of work around this, both as the state and with our partners in OHA, as well as our private sector partners, around that specific topic.
Might be useful to brief us on that, too.
Okay. Yeah, we can definitely do that, representatives.
Go on.
So this is the budget that we're using. Now, this is just the public health modernization budget that we've looked at. And what in 2016, we found that what we would need totally across the state of Oregon would be about another $105 million annually to really fully implement that framework and those activities that you saw on the grid related to the gaps in services that are available across Oregon. So in 2016, the Oregon Health Authority submitted for a first stage $30 million policy option package to request statewide implementation. In 2017, the legislature made an initial investment of $5 million. And this table just depicts what was the difference when we came here with what we asked for and what we would do and what we will be doing. So our activities are focused again. We definitely know that we have limited ability to move the system this way, but we also know that we have to stage this. We have to get proof of concepts. And as I said, if you looked at the RFPs, this will give us an opportunity to evaluate what people are trying to do and see how we can have horizontal learning across the state what works and how to bring in more partners to achieve the goals to fill those gaps in service delivery for Oregonians.
If you can keep looking for change in the cushions of the sofa to help us out, that would
do my best.
We heard it here first.
We keep talking to the Ways and Means Committee, and I'll continue to fight for that. And I think they're very responsive. It's just that it's a big problem.
It's a big problem, yeah. And there are a lot of competing needs for Oregonians. So this is our timeline. And the table shows the phase-in of the public health modernization priorities: communicable disease control, health equity, and cultural responsiveness assessment and epidemiology. Again, we're trying things out. It's the first time we've had regional approaches to some of these really big macro issues for the state. And our job going forward, because we do have things like other issues coming up, other important things to Oregonians, but we need to stay focused for this work on driving the system change for modernization.
Well, and if you could take some time in the interim to brief Representative Vial and Representative Salinas.
That would be my privilege.
That would be very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So here's our priorities. And again, these were determined not just by the state and the public health division, but with our advisory board, with county input, and also with other stakeholder input. So we look forward to evaluating what comes out of this. We are going to make sure that we're interested in making sure that on the state level, our biggest responsibilities are really driving, making sure people have accurate data, making sure people have data that reflects what their communities need to make decisions. And we'll be working on that infrastructure and being able to make sure that people have access to that as we move forward and evaluate. So other questions? And as I indicated, and Representative Greenleaf knows this, and so does Director Allen, I'm happy to talk about this at any time with anybody. And any other details that you want, we'd be happy to provide.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks, Pat. Hang on. Let's move on to an easier topic now. What's going on at DCBS? Now that Pat's deserted the ship there. Can we have the next group? We have about 20 minutes for your report, I think.
We won't take that long. So, good morning, dear Greenlit members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jean Strait, and I'm the acting director for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And here with me today is Chickie Flowers, our administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, and T.K. Keene, our Deputy Administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation. So I will talk to you a little bit about our leadership transitions, give you an update, and then T.K. will talk about the cost-sharing subsidies, and Chickie will give you an update on the Oregon's 1332 waiver. So as you know, on September 1, DCBS did lose two important leadership people in our agency. And we have been, so that was our director and our administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation. We are in the process of recruiting for the administrator. Final interviews are coming up at the end of this month, and we are actually on track to probably have an employment offer first part of December. So that will be good. The governor's office is managing the director's position, and interviews are taking place, and they will be reaching out to members of the committee and giving you an update this week on that position. So, though, and luckily, we have not had anyone else leave DCBS in the last couple of months. So that's the only leadership transitions I have for you. So,
good.
Any questions? If not, I'll turn it over to TK.
Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Gene. So, members of the committee, my name is TK Keene. I'm Deputy Administrator with the Division of Financial Regulation, and I'd like to speak with you for a little bit about our 2018 rate review process, as well as our response to the loss of the federal cost-sharing reduction. So just to provide some background information, the Oregon individual market is made up of 210,000 individuals. The split on that is 130,000 that are on exchange and 80,000 that are off exchange. Our open enrollment period, which is currently going on, runs from November 1st to December 15th this year. In plan year 2018, there were seven different carriers offering plans. Rate increases range from an average of 3.5 to 19.2%. To peg for you some approximate pricing, Silver Standard plan premiums for a 40-year-old in Portland range from $384 a month to $484 per month. And it's worth noting that the figures I just gave you there are reflective of the new Oregon reinsurance program, which reduced rates in the individual market by 6%. Turning next to the other market that we set rates for, the small group market. In that market, there are approximately 170,000 individuals. Nine companies participate in that market, and for plan year 2018, average rate increases ranged from 3.3 to 10.1%. I'll next turn to our response to the loss of the federal cost-sharing reduction payments and the impact that had on our individual rates. So cost-sharing reduction plans, or CSR plans, are plans with low deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance for consumers. Insurers are compensated for those lower deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance through the CSR payments made by the federal government. CSR plans are available in our individual market to households earning between 100% and 250% of the federal poverty level that choose silver level marketplace plans. Insurers offering plans on the marketplace must offer CSR plans, and there are approximately 50,000 Oregonians that are presently on CSR plans. It's been the subject of some legal controversy for some time as to whether or not the CSR payments would be paid at the federal level. The dispute centers on whether or not Congress needs to specifically appropriate those funds, or the executive branch can do that on their own accord. For that reason, we had anticipated for some time that CSR payments wouldn't continue indefinitely given the legal dispute, and that they were a month-to-month payment issued at the discretion of the White House. So most state regulators did not view it likely that these would continue on indefinitely. During our 2018 rate review process, we asked carriers what the rate impact would be should the CSR plans or CSR payments be lost. Information obtained from the insurers from Wakely Actuarial Consulting and the Congressional Budget Office allowed our actuaries to calculate the value of those payments to be approximately 7.1%, a 7.1% increase for the individual market silver plans. We received notice in mid-October that the executive branch would not be making the CSR payments. We contacted our carriers and began to work through our contingency plans, which had been in place for a prolonged period of time. We've been working for the last year or more with our stakeholders, both carriers and consumer advocates alike, to figure out what we would do should certain contingencies occur. And unfortunately, where we were at that particular time was that rates had already been loaded onto the federal IT platform, so we were limited in what we could do. The very next day after that announcement, our federal partners at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services reached out to us and offered us the opportunity to have a four-day limited window to reload rates to take account for the loss of the CSR payments. Upon hearing that news, and worth noting there that absent that outreach, we would not have had the opportunity to reload the rates. So that's not technology that we control ourselves or something we could do on our own accord. So upon hearing the news from our federal counterparts, we then reached out to our carriers, made them aware of this opportunity, and all of the carriers opted to reload their rates to take into account the CSR, the loss of the CSR payments. We had considered many strategies over the last few months on how to best account for the loss of CSR should that occur. The strategy we came up with, which is also shared by over 30 states, was to load that onto the silver plans. What that means in practical terms is for those that are subsidized with silver plans, the brunt of that 7.1% increase is offset by, for the most part, by the advanced premium tax credits that they receive. And so the impact of that is somewhat limited. For those that are on unsubsidized silver plans, they would get the full 7.1% impact. And for those selecting other metal tiers, such as gold or bronze, they would be unaffected by the changes that we'd made because we'd put it all onto the silver plans. Given the unknowns on how CSRs would be distributed across the various carriers for 2018, we became concerned that the market could become unstable. And so in that environment, we had asked our carriers to all reload rates, and they opted to do so. DCBS, in consultation with our legal counsel, walked through the different options for modifying the rates, and we were advised that what we could do was reopen our existing public comment period that carriers had, or when carriers initially filed rates, and extend that, as well as obtain the written consent necessary by statute for them to reload the rates by them actually reloading those rates.
We did that in 4 days?
Yes, correct. Which is a pretty big lift for the carriers and for our staff, both in the marketplace and with the Division of Financial Regulation. But it was quite a over the weekend effort, and it was all hands on deck effort.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah. So during the reopened comment period, we received 13 additional public comments. Those comments got posted to our website and are still there today. In the recent past, just to provide the committee with some history on our extending public comment periods, we in 2016 had to reopen rates during the reconsideration of rates process to allow carriers to take on additional geographic territory. In sum, as Chair Greenlick referenced, this was an all-hands-on-deck effort, and, you know, it was something that I think in a four-day period went as smoothly as it could have possibly gone.
Senator Hayden?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Just quickly before you get too far into this, if the CSRs are restored, what is your plan to reimburse the silver plan people, particularly the ones that pay full rate, directly to the individual?
So, Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Hayden, that's a great question. And so there's been various ideas that we've had about rebating. Also, our federal counterparts at CMS have some ideas on how to do that. It is worth noting that in each of the or many of the pieces of legislation that do, in fact, restore those payments, they're also at the congressional level considering how rebating would occur. And one of the pieces of legislation, I believe it's in Alexander Murray, actually provides a mechanism by which to do that. So I think should the CSR payments be restored, more to come on how the specific rebating would work. But our intention would be that if CSR payments are restored and insurers are made whole, that the insurers would then not hold on to that money, that it would be passed back to consumers.
Well, I just want to get that on the record now because we have an experience with a prior reinsurance program or an MCO program that $50 million was left over and there was no contingency for that money to go back to the rate payers, so the insurance companies ended up keeping that money in a roundabout way or through the new reinsurance program. But I want to make sure that we have a plan in place if those are restored, which I think they may be. Mm-hmm. They may not be. Nobody right. really knows what the federal government's going to do. I want to make sure that we have a plan in place to reimburse the rate payer, not for the insurance companies to get a windfall again.
Yep.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, yes, I understand the point. And so our goal in this, once we've worked past the immediate impact, was then to work on contingency plans that should that funding stream be restored, how can we rebate that money back to consumers?
Okay. Great. You'll get back to us on that.
We'd be so lucky to have that problem.
So in terms of the broader legal impacts that are at play here, Oregon is part of a multi-state lawsuit to ask for the CSR payments to be restored. There's also court action at the federal level in the D.C. Court of Appeals asking for the funding stream to continue, so more to come on that front. As you might imagine, in an environment where we're changing rates so close to open enrollment, there's a potential for some consumer confusion, so we've been working closely with carriers to minimize the number of irrelevant notices that consumers may be receiving and seeing if there's ways we can better package up information for consumers so there's not confusion. One additional question we have been asked is whether or not any state funds were used to backfill for the loss of the CSR payments, and as I just described, the answer to that question is no. So with that, I'll stop and see if there are any questions regarding our activities around the CSR payments.
Well, let's move on.
Okay. I will next turn the floor over to Chicky Flowers.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chicky Flowers. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. As you all very well know, our 1332 waiver application was approved by the federal government through CMS on October 19th. And with that approval came a request for additional information in terms of revising or reevaluating our actuarial and economic analyses done by our weekly consulting firm. And because of the whole change of the rates for 2018 because of the loss of CSRs. And that report is due to CMS today, and we are on track to submit that today. After submission of that revised report to CMS, CMS has a 45-day period where they will do their due diligence, and they will then provide us with their final grant decision and grant award decision by the end of this year. At this point in time, that's our current update. It's after we submit this report, we will be waiting on CMS for their final decision.
That report's available?
Not yet, but it will be by the end of this day. We will post it on OregonHealthcare.gov, and we would be happy to share that information with you.
Great. Are there any other questions, this panel? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to talk now about maternal mortality review. Is that where we are? Okay. Would you call the panel, please?
Mark Tomlinson, Providence Health, and Kate Wilcox, Manager of Maternal and Child Health, Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you, Dr. Gappas.
I have some slides here. Good morning, Representative Greenlick and committee members. Just as we're getting started, I'll tell you a little bit who I am, who we are, and why we're here, and then present a short amount of data on maternal mortality. So I am I'm representing the Oregon Perinatal
Alliance. Can you introduce yourself, please?
What's that?
Your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mark Tomlinson. And I am representing the Oregon Perinatal Collaborative, which is a group of institutions and obstetricians that are trying to improve health outcomes for pregnant women and their children. We have representation from OHSU, Kaiser, Legacy. I'm with Providence. And we have the Oregon Hospital Association and several members, Acadia is one, from the Oregon Health Authority. I also am the medical director for obstetrics in Providence in Oregon and a practicing maternal fetal medicine specialist. So I guess if I just click, this will go. maternal mortality has been catching a lot of attention in the country, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with the ProPublica NPR series that was published or broadcast in May of this year, and it draws attention to the increasing problem that we have. And this is just to add kind of a human face to the numbers that I'm going to present here in a moment. And the patient that they presented in this vignette was a relatively young woman. She was in the healthcare. She was a nurse in the neonatal intensive care unit, so she knew the territory. She delivered after a long labor, but after labor she developed severe hypertension, and then she also developed severe abdominal pain. These are pretty classic findings for a condition that's unique to pregnancy, preeclampsia. It can be life-threatening, but it wasn't recognized. And because it wasn't recognized, it wasn't acted upon. And within 24 hours, she died. So overall, though, maternal mortality in the U.S., when you look at the last century, it has been a success story. In the early 1900s, we went from nearly 1 in 100 women dying now to 1 in 5 to 10,000. But when you go and you look over the last three decades, that trend has started to reverse. Hmm. We don't have time to talk about why, and we don't completely understand it, but the bottom line is it has been reversed. And data in Oregon is a little bit harder to come by. But it's no different. The bottom line of the graph shows the actual number of women that die in the state each year with pregnancy-related problems. And the top line is just the rate, and it is trending just like that in the U.S. So the next obvious question is, how do we compare to other countries? And the answer is not so well. When you look again at the last three decades, this graph here, or this bar, shows what the most recent rate is, and we are twice what the other industrialized countries are, and we are the only country that's had a significant increase. And as a result, our professional societies, the CDC, has started to put a lot of attention to this. Everybody else isn't there. California is one of the leaders in what they've done, and just to talk about this table here, these are the most common, four of the most common conditions that lead to maternal mortality. They account for about 60% of the deaths. And they went and they looked at each and every one of these cases and they said, could this death have been prevented? And if it couldn't absolutely be prevented, did we have an opportunity at least to prevent it? And when you add those two columns up, what you see is pretty striking. 90% of these deaths in California at least had the potential to be prevented. They went a step further and said, okay, what can we do to do these? Just the numbers aren't going to help you make a difference. But they actually looked at facility-related issues, patient-related issues, and provider-related issues, and they quantified them as to what the components in these deaths were. And I've highlighted a couple of these, but where we have the biggest response is us, the providers. As in that case that I presented at the beginning, delay in response or ineffective therapy, denial and delay, it's called, has led to a lot of that. And with this information, California has put in developed programs and toolkits and put them into action. And what they have done is they have actually reversed the curve over the last few years. And they have made these things available, these toolkits and things, to everyone, and we are implementing them here in Oregon. The challenge with Oregon is we are one of the 18 states that doesn't have a maternal mortality review. The CDC is pushing for this, but we don't know where we are lacking and what's happening. And so my plea is that we start to move forward and to help establish that. Now, one of the benefits, mortality is just kind of the tip of the iceberg. Many providers, because it's quite rare, may never see it. But for every case of mortality, there is 100 or more cases of severe morbidity or bad things that happen to women. And many of these we know could be prevented. And that's where the real money is going to be, in improving lives of the women and the children. So that's... So
my question's really basic is, do we have to pass a law to be able to track this better? I mean, can't just some... I mean, maybe it's a budget problem, you know, but, like, seriously, we can't just collect the data? And
we have to pass a law.
We have to pass a law?
That's crazy.
They'll get to that.
Yeah, let's finish the recording.
Well, that actually is the end of what I had, and so we left time for questions and Kate. But, yes, there are barriers to it. It's not as simple as going out. We don't have access to the data. There needs to be administrative support to do this.
Hospitals track all this, right? I mean...
But we don't have a way to put it together.
What is the Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Board?
What is it?
What is it?
It's a multidisciplinary board, and the CDC has set out toolkits that help you establish it. But it reviews each of these cases and then looks at preventability, and then hopefully...
And that's in place here now?
It is not in place here now, no.
We don't have a mortality board.
We do not. We're one of 18 states that does not have it.
I have a question.
Any guy, do you have a comment on
this? Well, my comment is that this is one of my personal bills, and I hope to address this, and I hope for support from this committee. So we've had discussions on it, and you can hear more about why we need a bill and what we plan to do.
And that's a bill that's going forward in this.
It's a personal bill that I intend to introduce in 2018.
Thank you, Chair. I'm so glad to hear that. So I was.
I hear you're leaving us.
I know. I'm sorry. I'll still be here. I was a preeclampsia sufferer and had no idea what to look for. So, and nearly died. So just curious, when you talk about the toolkit, can you tell us a little bit about what that is? I'm just curious what's contained in that. And
the toolkit for preeclampsia.
Way to be there once again. Way to take the charge on and yet another important issue that we had no idea was not even out there, that we weren't doing this.
She represents Vale. How much fun it is in Vale.
So there's a couple of issues there. One is the maternal mortality, and there is the thing to establish that, and there's some guidance to do that. The other is just preeclampsia, and yes, you know, just raising awareness is the big thing, and then getting folks to understand the simple thing. What you describe is very, very common, is that preeclampsia affects probably 5% of all pregnant women. Very rarely do they die with this, so it often gets normalized. We call it normalization of deviance, and raising that awareness and being able to put stories to it helps people realize what's happening. But
because you wake up one morning and you have no idea what just happened to you, and your doctor, I mean, you don't have those conversations to know, oh my gosh.
Well, but you think an intensive care nurse would have a sense of that.
Well, I woke up the next morning and I'd gained 13 pounds and didn't know why, and I didn't know why my nose was bleeding and I didn't know what was going on, and you truly don't know, and you're at a point where you could die right then and there and you don't know. So the education piece is huge with this. So I hope that within that toolkit is information to educate women on, if these things happen to you during pregnancy, go now. I mean, that is hugely important.
So that's one of the things that California
found. And if I was still
going to
be here, I'd be right there championing this with you, because this is so important.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more.
Thank you for stepping up to do this.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I was curious, particularly on the it seems you have better data in California and no data on Oregon, but is any of this data site-specific, meaning at-home births versus hospital, or is it all hospital-based? Data that you're able to collect and you're not able to collect at home births, or how does that
work? Oregon is one of the, it obviously has the most out of hospital births, and for probably the last 3 or 4 years they have separated those that are intended to be out of her hospital versus those that just happen to be out of hospital. So again, I can't tell you whether they the deaths occurred out of hospital. Most of these are going to be in hospital, but not all of them, because they tend to be sicker patients, and so they tend to be more in the hospital. But again, that's certainly something that's important. We do have some data on neonatal deaths on the out-of-hospital births. But again, Oregon is one of the very few places that looks at out-of-hospital births as place of intended and not just where it happens, because there is a lot of crossover.
And on your neonatal deaths in Oregon, what are the differences in hospital, out of hospital?
The numbers are small. They are pretty similar. But when you actually look at the few cases, and I haven't seen this data in probably since about the first report in 2014 or 15, almost all of them that were out of hospital births were not very good candidates. They were twins or they were early patients, early babies. So those are the primary things. Out-of-hospital birth can be very safe if the patients are chosen properly.
Representative Bile?
That's not always what's happening.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I just want to confirm that I don't see anything in your materials or I didn't hear anything in your testimony to give me the impression that this is an economic or an access to services issue as much as it is just a understanding and delivery of information issue.
So, and maybe Kate can comment on this as well. The answer is we don't know very much because we don't have good data. But there are racial disparities. African Americans have about three times the mortality rate. But California also was able to bend that curve as well just by doing the basic things. So I don't know that access is a big thing. Patients don't always come in on time, partly because they don't understand or don't know. Sometimes they don't think it's a big deal. So there is some of that in access, but not that they can't get to us, I don't think. But I don't know for sure.
You have something else to offer?
Chair Green, like I also have a testimony that might address some of these
issues.
Please
go ahead.
Okay, great. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Kate Wilcox. I'm the Maternal and Child Health Section Manager for the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to share with you some information regarding these committees. I was going to start off with some of the background data, but Dr. Tomlinson has done a great job with that. In 2006, Oregon began reporting pregnancy status on the death certificates for women 10 to 60 years old. The medical certifier indicates if she were pregnant at death within 42 days or within 1 year prior to her death. This may provide basic information about the causes of death, but does not point to specific individual or systemic factors that contribute to the death, nor does it determine if the death could have been prevented or identify points of intervention to prevent further deaths. This is why maternal mortality and morbidity review committees are seen as a tool in the prevention of maternal mortality and morbidity. This type of review is a standard comprehensive system to identify, review, categorize, and analyze maternal deaths, disseminate the findings, and then act on the results. So the ultimate purpose is to stimulate action to prevent not only the deaths, but the more numerous cases of severe and non-severe morbidity. The committee's job is to answer the question, what happened? Look for points of intervention at the practice and the systems level and identify primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention strategies. Nationally, nearly 60% of maternal deaths investigated were deemed preventable. So through various linkings of data, different data sets, we can more completely initially identify the cases. Then through a robust medical records review and other methods of collecting social, economic, and healthcare information, a more complete understanding of what happened can emerge through an epidemiological analysis. The CDC has been mentioned as they have a complete toolkit to support states in initiating and implementing this type of review committee. I do want to reiterate that the real value of these committees is identifying what is causing women to be at risk in the first place. We need to capture enough information to better understand the impact on health equity and the disparities some communities experience, but we also need to understand better what is happening not only inside the clinic or hospital setting, but what's happening outside in the communities where these women live, work, play, and learn. There's a whole lot of information we can learn and prevention strategies we can probably identify. Thank you for the time, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. I expect we're going to hear a great deal more of this before we get too far.
I just want to make a couple of comments, too. I want to do a shout-out to Marguerite Cohen, who is my constituent, who is the Western Regional Representative for Government Relations for ACOG. The remind me what ACOG stands for. American Gynecological.
There you go.
And so I know she and Dr. Tomlinson have been working really hard on this with the Perinatal Collaborative for the last couple of years. And the toolkit that was mentioned is a toolkit that I believe CDC has developed to help states figure out what are the pieces of legislation that they might put in place to allow this to go forward. So some of it is, where would this Maternal Mortality Review Board sit? And presumably it would be in under the Office of Maternal and Child Health, which Kate Wilcox runs. But there are many other things that we need to do to ensure that this review board has access to the vital records. And right now that is not possible without legislation. We have to give that kind of access. But along with that, we need to ensure confidentiality and protection of case information, protect committee members, review proceedings and findings from subpoena and legal action. So there's a number of things that would need to go into a bill that would allow this to go forward. And, of course, there would be a fiscal impact as well, because we do need staffing to collect the information, analyze it, and, most importantly, make recommendations. And I do want to address the equity issue that was raised. African-American women suffer mortality and morbidity in general across the nation 3 to 4 times the rate. We don't know exactly here in Oregon because we're not comparing and analyzing that information. Mm-hmm. Presumably it's similar. Our rates actually are at or below the national average, so it's not like, oh, Oregon is a huge crisis. But if you can save any lives for the 12 women that die in 1 year, it's between 4 and 12, if you can save some of those, and 60% are apparently preventable. Dr. Tomlinson showed the ones that are almost entirely preventable, and those constitute about 60% of the deaths. So whether it's education, whether it's access to care, whether it's other social determinants of health, those are the kinds of things that I'm really excited to find out. So you will be hearing more.
Thank you for bringing this up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll move to a report on the process going on right now to consider whether PEB and OEB ought to be integrated. I'm going to call our...
We have Kathy Loretz, Executive Director of PEB, Oregon Health Authority, and Sean Parkman, Chair of the OEB-PEB Joint Executive Committee.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Who's going to start?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Sean Parkman. I'm the chair of the Senate Bill 1067 Executive Committee and also serve as the vice chair of the Public Employees Benefit Board. Thank you for the opportunity to share the highlights of the Senate Bill 1067 Executive Committee's work so far. I am here with...
I'm Kathy Loretz. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Educators Benefit Board and the Public Employees Benefit Board.
Today, I'll give an update on the work of the Executive Committee has been doing, and then Kathy will bring you up to date on the integration of the OEB and PEB at the administrative level. Senate Bill, just for context, Senate Bill 1067 was a cost containment bill passed at the end of last legislative session. It included several sections related to both PEB and OEB. The first item to be completed chronologically was the development of an executive committee. The bill required the two boards to appoint voting members to an executive committee. That committee would then take an in-depth look at the pros and cons of combining the functions and operations of the boards. And finally, a report would be made available to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by February 1st, 2018. OEB and PEB selected representatives from their respective boards to serve on the committee. An effort was made to have a balance of labor and management to offer the best representation of the OEB and PEB stakeholders. You can see here the individual members of the committee.
Sorry,
The committee made a decision to hold this, the scope to the development of a structure that would combine the functions. Whether to combine the actual enrollee pools for the purposes for purchasing a larger group would be a decision that would be made once the new structure was in place. Although an analysis of combining the enrolled pools will be included in the full report. Several different design models were discussed, paying attention to the impact on costs and stakeholders. Work is still underway on the cost implications of the designs and the makeup of the board. The plan will be completed in time to make a presentation to the Ways and Means Committee during the 2018 session. The plan will include a discussion of all designs discussed and include minority positions if there are any.
Sean, if you would plan on presenting it to this committee as well, that would be useful.
Chair Greenlink, we would be happy to present the findings to this committee as well. Any other format?
Good. Dr. Jockers, we'll keep an eye on it.
Rep. Greenlink, members of the committee. Again, I'm Kathy Loretz with PEBNOEB. So I'm going to talk a little bit about another portion of the bill which require that PEBNOEB work at combining staff members, our staffing at the and at the administrative level. So last fall of 2016, I was named as the joint director for the board. So the first item that, in the bill is that the executive director for PEBNOEB would be combined. So that's already taken place, and I've been in that position for about a year. And also, it is part of the...
Doubled your salary, right?
Pardon?
It doubled your salary when you took
that. That is the state way, isn't it, Rep. Green? I am also to report back to the legislature on an annual basis to talk about what the committee is doing, the two boards, at combining their functions. And then on the next couple slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happened at the administrative level with our combining of the staff. So several years ago...
Do you want to ask a question? No, go ahead.
Okay. Several years ago, the functions of the contracting unit of both boards were combined, and this is a unit that has three staff members, and they work on RFPs and contracting with all of our vendors. And the financial functions were combined back in 2013 into a single unit and have a single manager. Our executive positions were combined this just a couple months ago into a single unit. So those three areas are well underway. We are trying to fill one position, which would be the manager of our enrollment system area, so we can begin to look at our two enrollment systems in a more combined way. And then our member services is the only other area that's not combined, and we are working on that as well. We have a single manager, and we're just working on how that's going to work. We had our open enrollment seasons this year. OEB goes first and then PEB, and we were able to backfill and support each other during that time period, so we didn't have to use any temporary staff, so that worked out great. Because PEB and OEB's administrative budgets are 100% other funds and are collected as a percentage of the premiums, our funding streams will continue to be separate, as well as our position authority. Our enrollment systems are also separate and, unfortunately, are aging, so we are beginning to the process of trying to find a way to replace the system, at what point we would look at having a single combined system instead of two separate ones. And that's it for us. Sean and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I'd just like to comment as well. I've been fortunate enough to be the House representative on the PEB board, and it's been very interesting watching the operations. I just want to alert. My sense is the savings that are going forward for what we've been talking about right now, but I'm not convinced in advance that there is actually going to be savings from combining the two risk pools. They're very different kinds of risk pools. And at least at the moment, one is largely served in a self-insured way and the other in an insured way, and it's a very complex issue. But I will look forward to the report on on that, which I think will be a sort of preliminary report getting the discussion started. I think you guys are doing a good job. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Any other questions? President Buehler.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Green. Like, can you explain to me what the mission of PEB and OEB boards are and if those missions will be aligned in the joint board?
Me too. Board member would be good to know.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler. Actually, they are already aligned. Their main purpose for existing is to provide high-quality benefits that are affordable to both the employee and the employer. They both use evidence-based processes to determine what benefits are available. They look for ways to have member and provider involvement. We are all working towards the transformation of healthcare in Oregon by aligning ourselves with the metrics of the CCOs. And so we have been working towards the same goals for many years.
So follow up to that?
Mm-hmm.
So is there not an inherent conflict of interest with the makeup of the board that all the board members, it's also their insurance plan in terms of affordability and keeping those health care costs for the plan down? Who's looking out for the taxpayer on that? Because they're all conflicted.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler. Actually, on the OEB board, none of the board members, I don't believe, take are eligible for OEB insurance. No, that's not true. The management, there's two superintendents, and they are eligible, as well as two members that represent the counties. But we have board members, and we have two people that are members of the community that have either medical or experience in insurance on there. So the OEB board's a little bit different. On the PEB board, we also have a mixture. We have some of the management members are eligible for insurance, but we also have some that are not.
Who would that be?
That are not?
Yeah.
We have a member, an SEIU representative who actually works for SEIU, so is not eligible for benefits. We have someone who works for SAFE and is not eligible for benefits. We have an AFSCME representative who is an employee of AFSCME and so is also not eligible for benefits through our PEB.
But all their members are?
Their members are, but they are not.
So who represents the taxpayer on PEB to hold down costs and not inflate the benefits, value of the benefits? Do you have a vote? Do you have a vote?
I don't have a vote.
You don't have a vote.
I have a voice.
You don't have a vote.
As does Senator Johnson is on our board as well.
Non-voting members.
Non-voting members, that is correct.
But again, who has responsibility for holding down the lucrative benefits of the PEB employees
Checking
on that board?
Representative Buehler, we do have some
That's
caps.
That's not conflicted.
Well, we do have caps on our expenditures of 3.4 on an annual basis. So that is actually part of the 1067. It's now in law. So that our benefits on both the PEB and the OEB side will be held at a 3.4% increase for starters. And the management members of our board as well, I believe, work for... Actually, everyone does. Everybody on the board tries to keep the benefits down, the cost of our benefits down. That is their main goal.
Do you know how the cost of your benefits compare to all other states?
I do. I'm very aware of that.
Can you tell me what that is?
How we have a very rich benefit plan. We are, I believe, would be considered on the marketplace to be a platinum plan, all of the PEB side, not on the OEB side. The OEB side
on the PEB side, I think, it'd be a Rolls-Royce plan compared to almost every other state in the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's probably true.
This isn't the best conference.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll move now to a...
The facts are the facts, Representative Nos.
It's not a press conference, Representative Buehler.
Come on. Let's be fine. We have a little more report from the state hospital. Can we have the next panel?
We've got Arthur Toulon, Director of the Hospital System Analysis Management, Oregon State Hospital, and then we have Cody Gable, Aid and Assist Coordinator, Health Systems Division, Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arthur Toulon. I'm serving as the Director of Hospital Systems Analysis and Management at Oregon State Hospital. And I'm here to give you a brief update on the issues that Oregon State Hospital is facing because of the increase in the 370 population. So let me give you just a brief review of this 370 population, which actually is what we call individuals who are incompetent to stand trial. Oregon Revised Statute 161-370 establishes the process by which an individual who commits a crime that may also suffer from a mental illness can be sent for treatment if deemed not to be competent to stand trial. Under this order, the individual is sent to the hospital or the best setting to address this issue is to regain competency.
You know, sometimes you hear that referred to as the aid and assist, population. And sometimes 370, which is the ORS that covers the... Yeah,
so kind of in our lingo, the terminology became 370 population, but actually these are folks who are not able to aid and assist in their own defense, or they're not competent to stand trial, right, to understand the proceedings. So the whole idea with the statute, what they try to address is the right treatment in the right setting at the right time. Many times, folks are thinking of the Oregon State Hospital as the default for individuals to be restored to competency, whereas many times they could be restored in the community or restored in other places than the state hospital. The reason that we're talking about an update is that for the last 7 to 10 years, we have seen a constant rise in this the number of individuals coming to the hospital under these statutes 161-370.
Can you just put a little more background on it? It's the state hospital population is really three parts. It's one part, the aid and assist population. The second part are people who are there because they've been adjudicated as guilty except for insanity. And then there's the civil population. About two-thirds of the beds, as I remember, are made up of the forensic population.
You are correct.
Only one-third of the beds at the state hospital are made up of people who are civilly committed.
It is great that, as a member of the board, Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, you are familiar with all these numbers. And actually, that points out the dynamics, the hydraulics that are caused, because folks are looking at, well, you have a number of beds, you can admit these individuals, but every time a certain population increases, you have to figure out, because the bed capacity is limited, right? It's, in the past, Oregon State Hospital used to be able to just add bed capacity by adding a few beds in a corridor or in a side room or somewhere. We do not have that any longer with the new facility due to licensing issues. So the number of beds is limited. So once you reach capacity, in order for somebody to be admitted, you have to discharge somebody. And because of this dynamic of folks that are guilty except insanity, folks that are civilly committed, and the 370 population, we're constantly looking at the hydraulics. So if you squeeze the balloon on this side, it will pop out here. So this is constantly one of those issues that we have to watch the numbers and the bed capacity to be able to accommodate admissions to the hospital, especially that the 370, and I'm apologizing for referring to them as the 370, but that's the language. This population is the easiest door to open for admission at the state hospital because of a settlement that requires that within 7 days from issuing the order for somebody to get treatment at the hospital under the statute, we have to admit that individual in the hospital. So we have 7 days window to admit somebody. It's the quickest door, therefore it is used quite often. The idea behind this statute is to pay attention to three different elements. One is public safety. There are individuals that are indeed extremely dangerous that can be restored and can be treated only in a safe, in a secure setting. Also, there is the issue of paying attention and responding to the person-centered recovery issues. So the needs that individuals have for treatment and where they can receive that treatment. And the third issue is balancing that the wise use of state and county funds, because this is an issue that involves also the state, but the counties, providers, the courts, district attorneys, public defendants. So it's really a complex system. So what happens to an individual once they come into the hospital under this order? They will undergo an evaluation that is provided by the Forensic and Evaluation Services, forensic evaluators that are credentialed in the state of Oregon. And there are three outcomes of this evaluation. The first outcome is the person is able, regained capacity to aid and assist in their own defense and to understand the court proceedings. In that case, the individual found able is sent back to discharge from the hospital, sent back to the jail, waiting for the court date. The second category is not able yet, which means that at the time of the evaluation, the person, in spite of the treatment, has not regained full capacity to aid and assist. Therefore, we will continue the treatment until they regain that capacity before the end of jurisdiction of their time at the hospital. The third category is the category never able, which means that in the foreseeable future, these individuals will not regain competency to stand trial. In this case, never able, the court dismisses the charges, and there are a couple of options. Person is discharged back into the community with no charges, or the person can be civilly committed and sent back to the state hospital under civil commitment. Any questions so far? I'll be.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Just a question.
What percentage would you estimate are in that never able category?
I don't have the most current estimate, but I can get that for you from the Foreign Evaluation Service, because that estimate changes.
I'm sure it does, yeah. But I think it's a crucial factor here. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll make sure that we'll provide that information for you. So the next slide. Yes, I'm sorry.
So I'm not exactly clear about that last category. Can you give the example of a kind of, I guess it's a crime that got them there, that then they might be discharged for because they're not able to assist in their own? I don't understand that. From a public safety point of view, I don't understand that last category, mm-hmm. where someone might be discharged because they're not able to assist in their own defense. Is that what you're saying?
So the statute requires that an individual who's never able to regain competency to aid and assist cannot be held in double jeopardy, right? So what it says that at that time the court has two options. One, dismiss the charges and discharge the individual. And generally that happens with individuals with lower level crimes.
Okay.
Folks that are more serious crimes and they're found never able to aid and assist, rather than being completely discharged back into the community, they will enter a different system, which is a civil commitment system, to get the treatment that they require. Because most of the reasons for people not being able to aid and assist is their mental health status. So they need to be able to get treatment for that in order to really understand their reality and understand their behaviors.
There are some number of people in that population that never should have been arrested in the first place. Mm-hmm. There was one, for example, who was there for what was the term? Malicious littering or something like that?
Malicious littering.
Yeah, and as we'll hear some of the numbers soon, I think, as we're trying to drop those numbers down, the answer is not getting them into the place, you know. When you pick them up for malicious littering, give them a cup of coffee in the shower and find a place for them to stay that night, and it'll take care of the problem rather than ending up using a
And you probably, Chair Greenlee, representatives, members of the committee, you probably heard in the past, and we have many examples, people arrested for public urination, people arrested for trespassing, people arrested for minor crimes. They are sent to the hospital and for treatment when they could have been kept in the community and received the treatment which they have not received, and they should have avoided this type of behaviors. But the community is concerned enough that the law enforcement are thinking, we are picking up this individual over and over and over again for the same behavior, so it's time to do something about it. So they end up coming to this door into the hospital to receive
assistance. What's the current number of 370 patients?
I can give you, I have yesterday's numbers, as this morning were not yet published. Under 370, we have currently 195 individuals at the hospital. And that's the trend that I wanted.
That's about a third. Yeah, go ahead and show us.
Yes. So you have the graph there. Shows, and we go back just to last 5 years to 2012, but we've been tracking these numbers since about 2007. Since 2007 to 2017, in 10 years, we doubled this population at the hospital, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at that trend, you will see that the trend is moving up, and we moved up from about 85 to 90 patients in the late 2000s. Into the 195 and 200s currently. We had two bubbles in spring of 2016 and then again late 2016 and first January, February of 2017 that raised this population to 240, 243 as maximum. Well, that has an impact of our ability to admit other individuals in the hospital. So the direct impact is that civilly committed individuals that should come for treatment, there are waiting on a wait list to get into the hospital. So it creates all kind of problems. Now,
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. One thing that I've been concerned about for a long time, and I think it's a failure of our system, is something pretty simple called pass the buck. When people are in CCOs, they hopefully have services for behavioral health issues, but if they do get a minor arrest, misdemeanor, or whatever, they immediately lose their health care coverage, which small rural counties simply cannot afford. And so small rural counties particularly have only option of saying, well, 370 population. And do you, at least that's my perspective. Do you see that or feel that as health care costs increase, these counties have to buy, you know, health insurance for them when they come in there? They simply can't afford it. If you've got a cancer patient or something like that, it's catastrophic to them. They have to go to their reinsurance programs. Do you think healthcare is driving any of this?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Hayden, members of the committee, we're seeing this trend, right? And we try to understand what's happening. That it's multifactorial, the etiology, the cause of this coming in. Definitely, once they come to the hospital, right, we are paying out of general fund for these individuals, right? So it's the easiest door to get somebody to get the proper services if they're not available in the community. But I think that there are your perception, probably from where you stand, it's accurate that this may be a reason, but it's really hard to tell whether this is the only driver that leads to this increase in population.
I don't think it would be the only driver, but it seems like we as a state have missed the point of making a pool for these people from whether it's private insurance, which we do require that them pay part of the county jail health, but the CCOs have no responsibility once it crosses that line. And the CCO may have been originally responsible for them, but if that treatment, the CCO fails, they end up over there.
But Representative Hayden, they need to be, in order to get into this population, they need to be charged with a crime. I mean, that's not something the CCO can figure out how to get them arrested so they can get them.
That is not my point. I get, but these crimes are charged.
I mean, I think expanding the 370 population reduces the access to the civil commitments, and that is a civil commitment process that the CCOs would like to have more access for. Because then they can do exactly what you're talking about. They can get rid of somebody that they should be taking care of.
And one of the things that helped us to be able to accommodate this increase, because as you see on the graph, the numbers are going up, is the fact that we experienced during the same time a decrease in the guilty except insanity population. So we were able to free up some beds to accommodate this population. But this trend, if continues, if you eliminate the two bubbles that you saw there in 2015 and 2016, which, again, we have no idea why, and we could not predict why all of a sudden we have that jump, nor could we anticipate why that decrease, because you see a decrease there, right? If you eliminate those two bubbles, you will see that since 2015, about spring of 2015 till now, we have been consistent around 190, 195 individuals, which still is way more than the capacity allocated for this population. So it has an impact on the civilly committed individuals that should come to the hospital. So briefly, I'd like to talk about the length of stay and the impact, fiscal impact, because there is a quite a financial impact by having this population in the hospital. The length of stay for individuals who are discharged between November 2016 and October 2017 has been 119 days, with a median of 72 days. Well, if you take the daily cost to treat this population at $1,198 per day, and you apply it to the average and to the median, you will have $142,500 and some dollars, and the median cost $86,000 for this population.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Green. Those are big numbers. So is there any way we can involuntary treat people before they are actually put into the state hospital? I mean, to go upstream to try to prevent? Why do they have to commit a crime before they actually get treatment?
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, actually there is a task force right now, a work group that is looking at the best way to approach this issue and prevent arrest and help individuals who are in need of treatment to receive treatment, because you are absolutely correct. Most of these individuals will not voluntarily enter a treatment program. So we're trying to address this issue with folks, representatives from multiple different sections. We have the courts, the district attorneys, judges involved in this, community mental health, county individuals, to look at what is the best way to approach. There is the balancing act here has to be between the need for treatment and the civil right violation. Mm-hmm. And I can talk about that piece very briefly because...
Very briefly.
Oregon Performance Plan, right, with the agreement that Oregon entered with United States Department of Justice, is trying to address this exact issue of making sure that we do not violate anybody's civil rights by keeping them in the hospital or in an institution longer than they need to be in there. So it requires that we perform according to some benchmarks, so we discharge people under 120 days, people that can be discharged that don't require hospital level of care. And once you determine that somebody is not does not need to be in the hospital, you have certain benchmarks. First year, 75% have to be discharged within 30 days. When you say that this person no longer needs to be in a hospital, we have 30 days to discharge. Second year would be 85% within 25 days, and third year, 90% within 20 days. And that's quite a task because you need to have community placements available to put those individuals there. So there is this balancing act, but to answer your question, yes, there is a work group that is trying to address this exact issue. How can we prevent folks from entering the criminal justice system and to receive the proper care when they need it?
I'd encourage the task force to look at the law passed in 2015 in the state of Washington, which allows for involuntary treatment to avoid this as well.
Thank you. We will.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And the board is something that has been bothering me, but I think we have room for the ability to move this quite a bit. We did change the statutes in 2015 to help deal with the guilty except for insanity population, and you did mention we've made some impact on that.
Yeah.
We'll hear about the PSRB somewhere along the line, which has also had some impact on it. Thank you very much. Let's move now to a very interesting issue about integrating oral health. I know my vice chair has been very much interested in this. We've come to some inkling that the head is connected to the body and forms the mental health and endowment. There's an interesting one. So will you call the next panel, please?
We have Matt Sinnott, Shannon English, Jody Schwan, and Debbie Farr.
That's exactly
right. That's my
concern. Yeah, or just when you see this person wandering the street.
Yeah.
You guys have about 20 minutes.
I mean, why do we have to wait for them to...
Hopefully we can buy some time back.
From this
good.
Point...
But it's an interesting story, so make sure you tell us this story.
Right. Someone's looking.
Well, good morning, Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee. My name is Matt Sennett, and I serve as Director of Government Affairs and Contracts for Willamette Dental Group. With me today, I've got the more important people, and I'll let them introduce themselves, and then I'll tee them back up as we dive into the content.
I'm Shannon English. I'm the managing dentist for the Eugene and Valley River offices of Willamette Dental.
I'm Jody Schwan. I'm a care advocate for Willamette Dental.
Good morning. I'm Debbie Farr. I'm the manager of government relations for Trillium Community Health Plan. We're the CCO in Lane County.
Welcome home, Representative Farr.
So, as we all know, over the last 6 to 8 years, as Oregon healthcare transformation was being architecturally brainstormed and structurally implemented, figuring out how to integrate oral health with overall health in a systematic and systemic manner has been thus far somewhat of an elusive target. In the quarter four of 2015, with the project that launched during calendar year 16, Willamette Dental Group, working with Trillium CCO, undertook a pilot initiative focusing on how to integrate the oral health with overall health, and we focused on sort of that Pareto rule of looking for that 20% that's consuming 80% of the resources. So naturally, as many on the committee probably are aware, there's increasing evidence of oral health's correlation with periodontal disease and its impact on diabetes, as well as probably the more obvious one, which is the impact of tobacco use as a precursor for chronic disease or just social determinants of health in general. So we took a tact to focus on our members that were shared members with Trillium that had higher extreme oral health risk, as well as a diagnosis of diabetes and or a known tobacco use issue. We also sought to model this sort of structurally around the patient-centered primary care home model. Understanding assignment to PCPCHs is one of the CCO's metric, as well as the notion being that a patient-centered primary care home is a more desirable place for people to receive care because of the core attributes that PCPCHs maintain around access, accountability, comprehensiveness, care coordination, as well as the ability to use information systems to more efficiently and effectively work amongst provider types. We believe this both when we incepted the notion and then as we worked through the process, we believe that this was an effective example. We did a mixed mode analysis of both qualitative and quantitative assessment to understand, was it effective? Could it be scaled? And what could we learn about it that we'd improve going forward, understanding that this was a beta in many ways. Also on hindsight, we looked and saw the alignment with, I think, important things for the CCOs and you, the legislature, around what the central tenets of a CCO are, what the new state action plan for health consists of, and its harmonization with the state health improvement plan, as well as the MAC's recent guiding principles on the future of Medicaid. We believe there's strong correlation and interrelation between all of those important policy guidelines or aims. And with me today, I have, again, Dr. Shannon English, that will be going through and speaking from the clinical perspective. And then as Jody introduced herself as a care advocate, that is our organizational title of a care coordinator. So a care advocate for us is sort of semantics to a care coordinator. And then obviously we have Debbie with us from Trillium to speak to more of the quantified outcome analysis that was done on this project. So right before I hand it off to Dr. English, this is sort of in the actual grant proposal we did with Trillium, some of the direct verbiage that we had used in it. And largely it's the italicized quote that this chronic disease dental management program was aiming to manage dental disease in Trillium members with higher extreme dental risk due to tobacco use and or diabetes diagnosis using evidence-based dentistry models, and again, principled off the architecture of a PCPCH. This project presented a unique opportunity to serve members in a truly transformative manner by strengthening the linkages between medical and dental care, as well as experimenting with options around alternative payment methodologies, which, as we all know, are important in their direct and explicit call out in some of those policy guidelines that I mentioned earlier. So enough for me. I'll let Dr. English sort of frame some of this and be able to speak into more of that clinical realm, as I think that's more interesting than listening to me talk.
Yes, it is.
So we started out in preparation for this. We trained some of our existing staff. We hand-selected them from each of our offices in Lane County to be a care advocate, which it gave them additional training. Some of that training involved motivational interviewing, some role play, and just some introduction to the program so they could be experienced enough to incorporate this for our patients. So we identified our patients that were at high risk or extreme risk for caries, which is the disease of cavities, or that had active periodontal disease. And amongst those that were identified there, then we found the ones that had diabetes or were tobacco users, and we started them on this program. What this program entailed was providing them with patient products. One of the products was chlorhexidine, which is an antibacterial mouth rinse, ClinPro, which is a prescription-strength fluoride toothpaste. It has about five times the amount of fluoride as regular toothpaste, and xylitol. And xylitol is it's not an artificial, it's a natural sweetener, but it is a sugar substitute. And it makes the teeth surface a little bit more slippery so the plaque doesn't attach to it. The bacteria try to utilize the xylitol, but they cannot. So it does cut down on the bacterial counts. It's also a great sugar substitute for diabetic patients in keeping their blood sugars healthier. So with the care advocates, the role that they took on was something that was natural for most of them because they were already very good with patient engagement and customer service, but it allowed them to provide more education to the patients. So when the patients came to them that had questions, they might not feel as comfortable asking the back office staff, assuming that, well, I should have understood that. They had more of a peer relationship with the care advocates, so they could ask them questions that they might not feel comfortable asking. They also made follow-up calls with the patients. And this is one more person that's involved in their care. The care advocates could also help facilitate calls with their medical providers, give them reminder calls. We would have the patients back every 3 months and also replenish their patient products and check and see how they were doing as far as their risk. This was also a role, too, for them to inspire the team. So it became more than just a care advocate role. The whole team was centered around getting these patients healthier, and we were looking at getting them dentally healthier. And what happens when you get someone's oral health healthier, it gets their overall health better. We were able to track this program through our electronic health record, which was nice as well. So I'm going to go on to this slide right here, which talks about kind of the oral health connection. And this allows for some opportunities for this to be utilized in the future with different populations as well, but it also focuses in on why this population was important. So people with periodontal disease are twice as likely to have heart disease. And people with diabetes tend to have gum disease, but with that gum disease, because it's an active infection, it makes it harder for them to control their blood sugar. But because it's also an inflammatory disease and there's somewhat of a wound involved, it's harder for them to control the periodontal disease. So it ends up being a double-edged sword. So the more prevention we can get in there and help them, especially if we catch it earlier, the more we can affect their overall health. Pregnant women, there is a linkage that we have looked at to preterm delivery with periodontal disease. And also the bacteria that causes cavities is passed from the mother to child. And it's not passed in utero, it's passed after the child is born. So the healthier we can get our pregnant patients, the healthier we have for our childhood population. Patients taking asthma are at greater risk of dental caries, dental erosion, dental candidiasis, which is pretty much thrush. And so we could help focus on their preventive dental care as well. Gum disease can also create problems for people with kidney disease and COPD. So a lot of opportunities there. Somewhat of the kind of the medical dental linkage has been broken for a few years, and or quite a lot of years. And a lot of organizations within Oregon as well as nationwide are working to kind of relink that. And this is a good example of why this is important. So I have Jody, who is going to talk a little bit more about her experience with being a care advocate.
Again, my name is Jody Schwan, and I'm a care advocate for Willamette Dental. I've been with the company for 13 and a half years. I was fortunate enough to be chosen for this program, and I am absolutely delighted that I get to be part of something that we will, in the state of Oregon, see the impact for years to come. Very much a relay is what this program is. It started with the funding, of course, handed off to Matt and down through clinical, and we are the next leg of the relay, the care advocate. The patient, oftentimes, they'll hear everything in the operatory, absolutely everything the dentist said or the clinical staff said, but there's a shame and embarrassment around that with somebody that you have that much respect for. But the key aspect for us is very much that we are the peers in their eyes, very much the person they connect with already in many ways. We would take our leg of the race, do ongoing education, show pictures, be blunt in ways that dentists are not, speak to them at length. We had more time to do so also. A big part of the program also, and what made it very successful, was the ongoing connection with the patient, the commitment to calling, the commitment to setting them up for success, helping them realize this isn't, again, not a race. This is something that we're all very much a work in progress when it comes to our oral health. So helping them see that, helping them realize that the reality is that this will not happen overnight, very much a process. Delightful to see that connection work. I've spoken with patients, counselors. I have 62 of my own patients. Connection with counselors, connections with medical doctors, connections with the home in which they live, their endocrinologist, all of that thing. Been honored to be a part of that and help everything to work toward their health.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. So there's a high rate among Latino populations and African-American populations with diabetes.
Yes.
And I'd like to I better understand in the line of work that you're doing specifically in reaching out to folks. What does the organization company do specifically to reach out to multilingual, monolingual communities and education? And is there a communication gap, or are you guys communicating with their primary doctors? Because we, you know, a lot of us don't regularly see our dentists, right? But we know that there's folks who have diabetes.
Yes.
And they may have access to dental care or not. And if they do, what kind of relationship do you have with their doctors to make sure that they are going to the dentist and accessing the resources and tools necessary to increase their health and better their lives?
It becomes obvious in the very beginning with the patient, their relationship with their doctor. So we were involved to the length and to the depth of which they needed us to be involved. There was no communication gap, fortunately, in my own location. We have somebody that speaks Spanish. Very, very helpful. As far as connecting with doctors, if it became evident, high A1Cs, you know, diabetics are notoriously self-confessors about the disease and where they are in the progression of their disease. So I had contact with them when necessary and when it was comfortable for the patient or when the patient needed an advocate for care, and not unless they did. It proved to be successful. the connections that we had were usually helpful in a big picture of their care. Transplant lists, things like that. Is that making sense? And is it answering your question, more importantly?
Somewhat. Follow up, Chair. You mentioned that you have a person who is bilingual, and I'm assuming you have multiple patients that are not English speakers. So I assume one person is not going to be able to reach out to all the people that you all are serving. So is there a plan for your organization to expand on that? It's just really important. When I see these kind of presentations, I want to see the big picture. Mm-hmm. I want to know what we are doing for all of our populations in the state, mm-hmm. and making sure that they are all reaching or having access to information in multiple languages. Yeah. Oftentimes, presentations don't give me that information, so I'm having to ask it.
I think that they can answer the question better about the big picture thinking.
Yes.
The company is going to do.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Alonzo Leon. I think what Jody teed up is sort of her role in maintaining those relationships or blossoming them further than where they are as a cultivating process over time. From a sort of structural programmatic standpoint, we, in the eligibility files that we get, we do have the ability to determine race and ethnicity, albeit limited. Because the data is sometimes incomplete or missing components of that. One thing our care advocates also do is when we get an eligibility file, if it's not disclosing the totality of race and ethnicity, they capture that gap at the point of service or over the phone when they're outreaching, so that we have the ability to, at least in our EHR, have a truer reflection of where that is. We mine that data to help us determine staffing of representative cultures and ethnicities for those members we serve. So we have centralized call-out functions that do have sort of more of a wider array of ethnic speakers of different cohorts within our population. We look to staff at the office level to make sure there is representation, but it's always a work in process. And in this pilot, we didn't know what we didn't know until we got into it. Mm-hmm. And so we've learned a lot about making sure we've got that not just in time, mm-hmm. sort of staffing look at it, because that tends to be just too late, but looking to make sure we've got sort of the hub representation as well as the spokes down to the office level. We also provide translation services at all of our offices, as well as translating documents into whatever ethnicity, and cultural representation needs to be addressed. So I think it's always something we're looking to be better at. Part of the care advocate training includes cultural competency training. So I think it's something that we are mindful to, but understand that we may never arrive, because it's a live organism of something that we've got to constantly be doubling down to make sure what we did yesterday is sufficient for what the needs of tomorrow are.
Yeah, and I follow up, and I do appreciate the outreach piece. That piece, I think, is a brilliant idea, because we know a lot of populations know they need resources and tools. They don't know the system. And having an advocate is absolutely critical, but I just want to make sure that you have people who can speak multiple languages, yes. who understand the cultures, who can walk them through the process so that they can access it, because we know that the resources are there. It's just how can we make sure that those populations are accessing the resources.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
I'd like to say in closing that the testimonies there, beautiful. The top one about the family that the children run in as if we are baking cookies. Absolute fact. He came in terrified, out of his mind, because he's a mess. That's how he describes it, a mess. An adult man crying. Right away recognizes the sign on my forehead. This is where you take care of that. Comes out from his appointment, belongs to the program, but so do the lives of five other people in his household have been impacted by this program, current with all of their care, and a learning has gone on. The change in the future takes place there. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll be brief. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm here today just to give you a brief outline of the cost analysis that Trillium did.
And apart from the obvious health benefits, we wanted to see would there be cost savings. So we looked at, in 2015 and 2016, the members who were enrolled in the program. We also examined costs for those who had diabetes or tobacco use who were not enrolled in the program. And I think you have this one pager that was created by our analytics department. But for those who were enrolled in the program, the cost savings was more than $500 per year. For those who were not enrolled in the program, their costs went up about $700 on average. So the results were $1,200 on average per member per year, about $100 per member per month. So 55 members were enrolled and finished the program. Of those 55, only 37 were continuously enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. So those were the members that we concentrated on to develop the cost analysis and determine the savings.
Any guy?
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you. Great work. Thank you for your investment and for your work in this. I want to reiterate what Representative Alonzo Leon said and ask that, you know, can you give us a breakdown by race of who is in the program being served? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you maybe have had culturally competent training, but maybe haven't hired people from different races. I would encourage that if indeed the population you're serving is from different races. So that's just one comment. The other is on the prenatal. Thank you for including that and calling that out. And I always see that as essential, huge return on investment, because it's not only the women, but the fetuses that are impacted by inflammation in the womb as a result of periodontal, which, as we know, is not just a short-term bacterial infection. It's a constant inflammatory factor that leads to more, not only early birth, but brain inflammation, ADHD, much higher rates in poverty because of a lot of things associated with inflammatory factors, including periodontal disease, chronic disease such as diabetes and heart disease. So that fetus, that's an 80-year return on investment. And for the children of that mother, when the kids stick their hands in her mouth and then they get it. So I'm passionate about that. And my question related to that is, do you also cover in this pilot or this program, did you include any of the fee-for-service women, pregnant women? Because that is a population we know that is even harder to reach, and that includes both that expanded Medicaid as well as the Cowan population. And Representative Hayden and I have found that typically, at least as of a couple, two, three years ago, we were only hitting about 20% of those women with any kind of dental visit, and the average first time that they were seeing any kind of dental provider was 30 days before delivery. So that's a population that we're really particularly concerned about.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kindergartner, to your question, on the fee-for-service, when CCO integration took place and it became time for dental to go through that process, once we completed our 11th contractual integration with our CCO partners, as a vertically integrated staff model system, we decided at that point that those 11 CCO partners were where we needed to focus our attention. We had about 1,200 or so fee-for-service folks that would have been left after that. We work with the Oregon Health Authority to transition those members in so that we no longer hold a contract for the open card. We closed that as of immediately after July 1st, 2014, when sort of the statutory integration waves exhausted their timelines. So unfortunately, that is a small portion of the population that we don't serve. So all of the members in this program, as well as all the members we serve in the Oregon Health Plan, are through our 11 CCO partners.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And that wasn't my question, but therein lies the problem with fee-for-service and oral health. There's basically no access across the state. My question was, though, on your control group that you're comparing the 37 members to, were they also enrolled actively in Willamette Dental Group?
Yes, they were enrolled.
So the patients you compared it to were enrolled with dental services?
And outside with a de-identified cohort of the other dental plans for control, mm-hmm. Were also compared against. We didn't set that. Trillium just analyzed a similar health condition profile.
So the 37 were in Willamette.
Yes. The 37 were in Willamette.
But the ones you compared it to, how many did you compare that to?
A correlative sample size.
And they were in Willamette Dental also?
No. We compared a sample size of the Willamette, the 37, to a similar profile cohort that were assigned through Trillium, but to the other three dental plants. Not an equal apportionment across any, just a sample of non-Willamette-enrolled Trillium diabetic and or tobacco-using members.
So you have disparities between fee-for-service, different dental plans. So is there part of this that just getting dental care at all helps drive the cost down?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, I think it's hard to say no to that. I would agree that something's better than nothing. But I think it's sort of that the statistic that we hear, you know, 85% of health happens outside of the healthcare system. I think that was a heavy driver for why we saw positive change. I think we provided a sample of the testimonials, and Jody being somebody that lived and breathed it, and Dr. English being a provider that enabled it. Those relationships outside and the bilateral accountability it created, where it wasn't just a care advocate calling the members they were working with. There was also times where the care advocate may get a call from the member saying, you know, I wanted to check in with you. And it became a empowerment structure. It's not something that's not replicable. It's scalable to overall diabetics within CCOs. It's not something that would be unique and only capable of being programmatically implemented across dental plants. I think it is a framework structure that's foundational that others can model, or that we can work with CCO partners as a dental plan amongst others to take to scale for overall diabetics or even other chronic disease populations that we know have similar value propositions in terms of what a program like this can do to better connect the health that they're getting rather than leaving it disconnected and siloed.
Then my follow-up question is, you spent a little less than 50% of the program because you didn't have enough patients, or 50% of the grant because you didn't have enough patients. Why not expand that to pregnant women? Why don't you get more patients in?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, we had done this through a grant program. And so we'd analyze the data to figure out what was the reasonable sample size of the members that fit sort of the profile we were seeking, and then capped it to make sure that we didn't sort of get into it immediately out of the gate, overpromise and underdeliver. We wanted to learn while we were doing it so that the lessons and the outcomes could be improved upon as we evolve this to something that's not unique to a pilot, but something that can be taken to, that's why we modeled off PCPCH design, something that can be taken to how we look at care delivery with integration of oral health being a part of it, as not something that you bolt on to the side or something that stays silo, but how we can use information and communication and model things that have already happened in medical, which obviously you're astutely aware of this, is probably 30, 40 years ahead of where dental is as an industry. So what can we do to align with the medical rather than requiring them to figure out how to align with the dental? If we meet them 75% of the way, it became easier for us to figure out the ways that we can work in a sort of triangulated capacity with the CCO partner and the medical dental providers, looking to eliminate that CCO point on the triangle so that we just have direct bilateral provider-to-provider interactions going forward, but we had to start somewhere.
Okay, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Interesting presentation. I think we'll agree to take the conclusion with a grain of salt, but it's an interesting demonstration. We're going to talk now about electronic medical records for a little bit, how they're interacting in emergency room.
We've got Susan.
Dr. Droppers, or you call it?
Yes, Chair. Susan Otto, Director, Office of Health IT, Urban Health Authority, Paul Matthews, Chief Informatics Officer, Ochin, and then Jennifer Stoll, Vice President of Government Affairs, also with Ochin.
Okay. Take it away. Make sure you introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name's Jennifer Stoll, for the record. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for OCHIN, formerly the Oregon Community Health Information Network. I'm here today to talk about the most exciting part of your day, and that's electronic health records and data, and how data moves in the healthcare system. And what I was hoping to do is spend a couple of minutes just orienting you to who OCHIN is, because we're an incredible untapped treasure in Oregon. We're based in Portland. And we are a nonprofit, mission-focused organization that helps the safety net providers in Oregon and across the country acquire technology and technology services at the most cost-effective structure. Now, we were built to do two different things. One is to help low-cost options for healthcare technology, but we were also built to create a very large repository of data to mine for safety net purposes, and that's where we are right now in terms of size. We have the largest data set of safety net patient level data in the nation with over, and I'll let Paul speak to that. By the way, I forgot to introduce Paul Matthews, my colleague. Paul is our chief technology officer and chief security officer for OCHIN. He's a nationally renowned speaker on data security and how data moves and flows. Okay, so here's our timeline. As I mentioned, we were incubated within Multnomah County and CARE Oregon to provide low-cost technology solutions. Electronic health records, if you're not familiar, are very, very expensive. And so what OCHIN has been built to do is create a large collaborative where members buy into the OCHIN collaborative to be able to offer low-cost technology solutions for their members. As you may probably appreciate, safety net providers may not have the staff to be able to support technology, never mind be able to manage it. And so we support organizations as small as a yurt out in Wheeler to Multnomah County and other counties across the nation. So these are the three different buckets in which our business is broken down. Technology, professional services around workflow and data security, and then again strategically built for research capabilities. So our research capabilities are very, very extensive. Researchers around the nation come working with us, but particularly researchers within OHSU, Kaiser Center for Health Research, and other partner institutions work with OCHIN to mine the data to really understand what's happening within the needs of the safety net. To that end, we currently have over 10 million medical records, and that's a patient seen within one of our clinics in our system, and we support our member clinics, and we have over 50% of the Medicaid population that in Oregon in our clinics. So we have a very robust data set in the clinics for analytic purposes. We also help support our CCO partners be able to get metric data so that they can work with you and achieve their goals. This is an example of how the medical record works in one of our big members, which is Multnomah County. We also support the Oregon Youth Authority, school-based health centers, corrections. On one medical record, we can see how patients are moving in and out of the system, as well as we're able to bring in other data sets, which I'm going to have Paul speak to in a moment. And our analytical capability within the safety net is pretty astronomical. We would really like to be partners with the state. We are a nonprofit and a true public partner, public-private partnership. So if you have any questions around this, please let us know. Including social determinants of health. We have been researching social determinants of health, and our EHR is exceptional in being able to look at that. And at this point, I'm going to pass it over to Paul to be able to share with you a little bit more about what data what we're able to capture within our data sets.
Thank you. So, Chairman Greenlick, members of the committees, welcome. Thank you so much for having us here. My name is Paul Matthews, for the record. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for OCHIN. I'm also the Information Security Officer. So I wear two hats. One is, how do I move the information? Second one being, how do I protect that information once it's moved? OCHIN, as an organization, has strived over the years. I've been there 18 years since its inception, to create a solution that allows us to take safety net records for patients who are being seen in federally qualified health centers, community health centers, public health facilities, and provide a repository of data, both from the data that we collect within the clinics, but also the data that we collect from the communities as well. So we also bring in information from other medical record systems, from hospital systems, from clinics that are not part of our service, to create this rich research repository. In that system, we're able to actually show not only race, ethnicity, we're also able to show the financial capability, the social determinant information, services for the medical side of the house, the dental side of the house. So we can actually match in the previous conversation diabetic patients to dental procedures that are being done, and not only on the dental products that we actually host, but we're also bringing in the dental information from other dental products, so mining their payer information, their claims information. This gives our researchers who have made about, who are actually on track right now this year, we get about 50% of all submitted requests for research are funded, which is a very high hit ratio on our research capabilities. And we're doing a lot of work around comparative studies. So taking information and being able to say, how is one provider doing on his protocols in an organization versus another provider? And if we say that, say, for a diabetic patients, take the same information and compare a clinic to a clinic. Take that same information and actually compare state to state. So we're able to show the differentiation between policy requirements that have been set and be able to say, what does this look like for an organization that is a Medicaid expansion state versus a non-Medicaid expansion state? And this comes from the scale of operation operating in all 50 states that we do. The other piece we do is move information for clinical purposes. So there's a lot of movement of information for research, but we also need to move that data for clinical purposes. And in those cases, we're on average moving 2 million patient records a month. So outside of our organizational structure, we're integrating that data into the hospital systems, into other clinical practices. I was actually in Bend recently. We actually had delivery of data to Bend Spine and moving those clinical records over to our clinical systems and integrating those back over into the hospital platform. So the movement of this information at scale, if you think about 50% of the Medicaid population receiving services in the state of Oregon, and we're moving then 1 million patient records is what that represents, being moved outside of our clinical system. We have an ability to show the movement of patients and the integration of that data. The other piece that we do a lot of is we act as sort of a laboratory. How do we test new ways of looking at information? So one of the things that we've done recently is work very heavily with Collective Medical Technologies. This is the organization implementing the Emergency Department Information Exchange. So we're able to actually see in the clinical record that a patient was not only seen through our normal health information exchange solutions. In this case, we have two products that we host. One is Epic, another is NextGen. We can see from the Epic to Epic side a large movement of information, but now we can actually see movement from other organizations. So I can say that a patient was seen at an emergency room in any state, and especially cross-border. I was recently in Open Door, which is a clinic in Northern California, Humboldt County. They actually see patients from Southern Oregon because it's the easiest place for them to get seen. So they'll make the drive into Eureka or into Crescent City to get seen in the clinics there because it's closer for them to provide services. And so one of the things we also are able to do is show those patients as they transition across state lines, Washington, Southern Washington into Oregon, Northern California. So I apologize for the accent. Sometimes I make things a little difficult here. So I'm going to pause there and see if there's any questions.
I have a lot of questions.
Go on your presentation.
Okay.
Representative, did you have a question?
Yeah. Bueller does.
Oh, Representative Bueller.
Okay, Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you. So just a point of clarification. So the EMRs that feed into your, what's the name of the integrator program?
So we actually have a couple of ways. So we have a We host two medical record systems. Okay. One is Epic, the other is NextGen.
Okay. But those don't merge
those,
the records?
Those merge from a patient treatment level,
okay.
But they didn't merge. In normal circumstances, they would not merge from an analytic standpoint.
You can't
We've
merge.
Taken that information and created a third product. The third product, we call it Acure. It is really a large data warehouse analytics platform.
Okay.
So we're bringing in data now from the two systems that we host, from legacy health systems. We're bringing in data from payers. We bring data in from Care Oregon. We're bringing information in from in other states. We're bringing data in for entire PCAs. Okay. And we're able to do that mining and analytics of that information from any EHR system.
Okay. So, but you're not merging the data from the different EHR systems? You analyze the data separately, but they don't merge?
No, we merge the data for analytics, but we also merge the information and transport the information for clinical care. So if a patient is seen on one platform, they're able to take that information and transition it to the other platform.
And how many EHRs can you integrate?
Today on Epic, we have, I think here, from a clinical standpoint, we have 113 organizations.
But how many different EHRs? So just Epic?
Oh, it's unlimited. Right now we integrate the top 10 EHR platforms out there in the market, but it doesn't stop us from integrating with any other platform.
And how many CCOs are putting their data into this?
Today, the CCOs don't put the data into us, but we're actually delivering data to the 10 of the 16 CCOs in the state for their analytics and for their metric measures.
So, clarification. So how, if they're not giving you the data, how are you doing analytics for them?
On the analytics side, it's because we're providing the majority of the care for the patients, the 50% of the Medicaid patients that are being seen by the CCO organizations.
Services.
So the direct services. So our clinic members, Multnomah County, Virginia Garcia, Mosaic Clinic, those organizations are directly inputting the clinical information into the medical record.
I see. I get it.
CCOs
and that's the data.
I
get
it.
And then we give that data back to the CCOs.
I see. Okay. So tell me what percentage of the Medicaid population in Oregon you have data for?
It's 50%.
50%. And where's... Okay. That's interesting.
Representative Alonzo Leon?
Yes, thank you. My question is more, it's bigger. I'm just trying to, I guess, grasp all the data and information you all have and how much of what we as a state capture and how much your organization captures. Yep. And how are we... connecting the two.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes
we as a state don't get any of that data.
Okay, so then that's my other question. So if we're not capturing any of that data, then we're counting on this organization to provide some of that data for us to inform us.
Well, let me be clear. There is an all payer all claims data system that we have, and some of that data is your data. So we do have that.
Right. So
how do you link to the all payer all claims?
Absolutely. Data? So. We capture the direct clinical information, so we have the clinical data. We also have the claims that were submitted and the remittances that were paid back by the payers to the individual. So we know for 50% of the population the direct reimbursement. The all payer all claims information is the data that is missing from us. We have some of that data. We have one payer that is submitting their information to us for mining purposes. We have built out the system and actually tested this with, and I forget the name of the new organizational name, it was referred to as QCOR originally. We worked with them to mine the information and develop an ability to ingest all payer all claims data as a pilot to demonstrate that we could mix both the all payer all claims and the clinical information. And for our goal is we want to be able to provide that information for research purposes to anybody, for public policy purposes or for an individual research. The other piece to an earlier comment of yours about being able to provide this on populations based on their ethnicity. So we can stratify based on race, income level, social determinant of data, and provide all of that information.
Ms. Otter, do you have something to present?
Yes.
Would you?
Yeah. Do you want to ask?
Huh?
Oh, I'm talking to the assistant to pull my slides up. So while she's doing that, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to give, I was asked today to give an update on the Emergency Department Information Exchange. So I'd like to give a little bit of history for the legislative context for the work we're doing. An update on EDI, the Emergency Department Information Exchange, the spread of EDI, and some early results from an evaluation, and then talk about the next steps in 2018. And I'm happy to also answer questions about anything else related to health IT. Okay?
Keep going.
Okay. So the role of health information technology in supporting health system transformation was acknowledged with House Bill 2009 and the establishment of the Health Information Technology Oversight Council, or HITOC, which is our stakeholder oversight body that sets the strategic direction for health information technology in Oregon, looks at policy issues and challenges and barriers, and makes recommendations to the state and to the legislature to move forward. In 2015, the House Healthcare Committee sponsored our legislation, House Bill 2294, to update our statute to expand the role that the state plays with in supporting health information technology. House Bill 2294 required OHA to establish the Oregon Health Information Technology Program. That really looked at formalizing work that was already underway at the state to implement programs and services to support statewide health information technology and advance those goals. Under the bill, OHA may establish health IT services statewide and make those available to stakeholders regardless of whether they are in the Medicaid program or commercial or what have you. We can enforce and establish standards for the participants of those services where there are challenges, particularly around what we call interoperability or the exchange of information or other challenges related to privacy and security. And then we can also participate in partnerships or collaboratives where others are creating health information technology services or efforts that it makes sense for the state to be a part of. The other component of the bill was it updated the HITOC statute so that HITOC now reports to the Health Policy Board and is aligned with the Health Policy Board's insights and vision for health system transformation. That one component in the bill that allows the state to formally participate in partnerships or collaboratives was particularly helpful in the work that we've done with EDI, the Emergency Department Information Exchange. That was established in 2015 as a partnership between the Oregon Health Leadership Council, the Oregon Health Authority, and many other stakeholders, including the Hospital Association and the College of Emergency Room Physicians. The EDI utility brings critical hospital event information from all hospitals in Oregon, adds that to information that's available for hospitals in Washington. EDI actually started in Washington State, and makes that information available back to the emergency rooms when there's a patient that shows up that's a high utilizer of services. So a real-time summary is given to the emergency room provider that shows the history of emergency room or hospitalizations for that patient, shows them a list of those ED or hospital visits, where they've been seen, for what issue. It also includes known care providers and also any care recommendations that have been entered into the system that are critical for the emergency room team to view in treating that patient. Pre-Manage is a companion tool that supports the same information but makes it available back to the CCOs, their care coordinators, health plans, and the clinics in order to manage their patients or members who are high utilizers as well. Pre-Manage can provide real-time notifications to a care team, for example, for an assertive community treatment team who is trying to manage individuals with severe and persistent mental illness that are at risk for institutionalization. It's critical for that team to know when their clients are in the emergency room. And so we have some care team members who are on an automatic alert, and they'll actually drive in their car to the emergency room to interact with that patient. And ensure that their care is care coordination is happening and that their care is the best it can be. Pre-Manage can also be used through dashboards that allow the care coordinators to view their populations and design cohorts for particular patients that they want to follow up on. And then pre-managed users can add those care recommendations that the emergency department can see and other users of pre-managed can see. The spread of EDI and pre-manage has been one of the highlights of my career in terms of successes in health information technology in Oregon. It's pretty rare that you roll out a technology tool that is so popular with emergency room providers or other clinicians or their staff. It's a really simple, thin level of information, emergency room and hospital events, and very simple care recommendations, but it's very effective to get that information in the right hands at the right time. This map shows the adoption of EDI and pre-manage by our CCOs, our hospitals, and ACT teams. All hospitals in Oregon have been participating in EDI since May of 2015 was when we had the last hospital join. We're still working on the Veterans Administration, so that's the exception to the all hospitals. Nearly all of our CCOs are using pre-manage through a subscription funded by the state. We have the map here shows counties where a CCO is using pre-manage. In Southern Oregon, our community health information exchange called Reliance eHealth Collaborative is now getting EDI data and providing that to its members through its health information exchange.
Is it linked with the prescription monitoring system?
It is now, and so that was one of the things I wanted to talk about as well. I've got a slide on that shortly.
Okay.
So two of our CCOs are not using pre-managed directly, but are have access to the EDI data through Reliance. So with that, 15 of our 16 CCOs are either using pre-managed or have access to that data. So that's very exciting. We're also supporting assertive community treatment teams, as I mentioned. We have about 15 teams that are up on pre-managed. This shows the adoption of EDI and pre-manage in Oregon. So health plans are also using pre-manage, paying for their own subscription to pre-manage. Most of our CCOs and health plans are sponsoring subscriptions for their key clinics. So clinics receive a full subscription for their full patient populations that they don't pay for, that are covered by their CCO or health plan. So you can see we have over 260 users or organizations that are using pre-managed today, and that number is growing. It's been particularly effective in working with behavioral health providers who, until now, have had very limited visibility into when their critical clients are seen in the hospital or emergency room. So we've seen some real innovations in some of our larger behavioral health providers actually bringing in the EDI data into their data warehouses, similar to what Paul was talking about, and being able to look at the return on investment and the outcomes for some of their clients that they're targeting. So, for example, one organization works closely with homeless individuals and was finding through their pre-managed data that intervention program was actually successful in reducing hospitalization.
You have about 5 minutes more.
Okay. So the EDI was established as a public-private partnership. The utility is the governing entity that manages EDI, and that is managed through a shared due structure and has hospital and health plan and CCO representation as well as OHA. The utility was set up as a three-year demonstration. 2015 to 2017, we did an evaluation mid-2017 to look at the results and whether we're achieving some of the goals we set out to achieve. The results, I've sent the EDI utility evaluation report to you all, so you can look at that in more detail. The high-level results are that we set out to reduce ED utilization across the state. We were not successful in that broad goal. However, did see some very promising results where we have patients that are high utilizers and have a care recommendation entered into the system. We saw a 10% reduction in ED utilization for that population. That's very exciting. We think the care recommendations themselves are really a proxy or an indicator that care teams have wrapped around these patients and are coordinating care. So there's some of the other results here as well. And this is just the 10% reduction slide, which I'd be happy to talk about further if you'd like. So in 2018, I'll just finish with the next steps and talk about the PDMP. The EDI utility public-private partnership model was seen as very successful in managing this type of statewide health information technology infrastructure and bringing learning collaboratives and other efforts to ensure that this tool was used and was used well. We're transitioning in 2018 to a broader public-private partnership called the Health IT Commons that will leverage the EDI utility model and include EDI as one project under a more umbrella public-private partnership structure that will add additional projects as we go. We're taking a crawl, walk, run strategy to really move very carefully and slowly forward, continuing the work of EDI, and then adding another project, which I'll talk about related to the PDMP. So again, this is a partnership between the Oregon Health Leadership Council, OHA, and other partners. In terms of the prescription drug monitoring program, we're pleased to support the public health prescription drug monitoring program efforts out of our Office of Health IT in launching a gateway service that allows systems like EDI to connect electronically to the PDMP registry. Currently, a prescriber needs to go to a web portal, log in to search for a patient and identify what controlled substance prescriptions that patient has had in the past. That takes a choice that a prescriber has to make, whether the person in front of them is someone that's likely to have a record in the prescription drug monitoring program. Best practice is to have that information electronically available within the electronic workflow of that prescriber or pharmacist or their delegate, so that information, they don't have to decide whether it's worth logging in and taking those actions. We launched the gateway service through a third-party vendor to allow health IT systems like electronic health records, EDI, and other health information exchanges to connect multiple systems to connect to a gateway that is then connected once to the PDMP registry. That gateway service also will allow Oregon's PDMP program to connect to other states' PDMP databases, which was just authorized through the legislation this year. So we're excited that the PDMP program will allow, will be able to connect to other states starting sometime in 2018. EDI has launched the PDMP gateway connection and has just last week started the first hospital in receiving prescription information within the EDI alerts.
Okay. Can you wrap up, please?
Sure. So the role of the Health IT Commons will be to remove the financial barrier that folks may face in connecting to the gateway. So we'll be funding a statewide subscription to the gateway services so that any provider, prescriber, or pharmacist in Oregon can connect their electronic health record, health information exchange, et cetera, to the gateway and not have to pay a fee. So we'll be bringing significant federal matching funds to bear, as well as a small increase in the dues that the hospitals and health plans pay for EDI to cover the non-Medicaid share of that statewide subscription. And that's it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you guys for your presentation. I really appreciate it. And let me, I have a couple of announcements before we break up. Let me first announce I'm starting a work group to look at the whole question of where we as a state need to go further toward achieving universal access to health care. I'm going to ask the work group to develop a set of recommendations for us for the 2019 session. We have a lot of uncertainty of what's happening in Washington, how it's going to affect our activities. Three of the House members will be on that. I've asked Representative Salinas to chair it, Representative Vile to join it, and Representative Barbara Smith Warner will be on it. We'll be releasing its charge sometime in the next month, and we'll be naming some other stakeholders to join that group. So if anybody within listening range is interested in being nominated as a possible stakeholder member of the group, I ask that you contact Dr. Droppers on that. He's going to be staffing the work group. working with the Department of Policy and Research.
Office of Legislative Policy and Research.
Legislative Office of Policy and Research, so we'll help that process. Representative Salinas, you want to comment on it before?
Yes. First, I just want to thank Chair Greenlick for his vote of confidence to the two newest members of this committee. I am hoping we can get a good work product. I think universal access, as many in Oregon believe, is really our,
You have to blame Representative Nose for that.
That's what I heard.
Everyone needs to have a task force to find out how hard it is.
It's a good hazing.
This is our indoctrination. So thank you, Representative Vial, for agreeing to work on this with me.
Okay, and we will probably have a request for 3 bill drafts that will come back to us for possible committee adoption in our December meeting?
No, January.
January meeting, right. We don't have a December meeting. Don't panic. One will relate to some further work looking at where CCOs go in the next generation. One will be about a organ donor recognition process, and the third one remains up for grabs with several nominees at the moment. Anybody have anything to add? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to also have you consider a bill regarding radiation, superficial radiation therapy. It is a skin cancer treatment that does not involve surgery nor scarring, and has been accepted in 41 states. And thus far, in endeavoring to work with the Radiation Advisory Committee, it's been stonewalled.
Would this be your personal bill?
I could use it as a personal bill. It just seems to me that it's an appropriate. Actually, it should be handled administratively, and Director Allen is working on that. But if it's not, it seemed to me like maybe it was a committee bill. It's more than just a personal matter. I think it's a matter of setting good policy. When you can treat skin cancer without scarring or surgery at a much lower cost with much greater benefit to patients, I don't understand the stonewalling.
Okay. I don't either. So.
Thank you. I thought you wouldn't. And I've been holding off because I thought it could be done administratively as it's been done in the other states.
Well, let's work with that.
Thank you.
Possibly. Anything you do administratively rather than statute, I'm in favor of.
I am too.
Representative Vial, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. First, I want to say I'm sobered to be here because I really do feel like I've got very little background and knowledge to offer. However, I've learned a lot even just in the last few hours, and am looking forward to making whatever contribution I can. I will say that the access to universal health care issue is one that I have a great deal of interest in, not only because I think it is a humanitarian issue for us to consider, but it also really does impact the very difficult balance that we have to achieve between managing our finances as a society and taking care of each other. And I think that that part of the discussion is something that I look forward to a very robust conversation about.
That's really at the heart of the issue.
It seems to me to be at the very heart of the issue. And then finally, I think maybe this public environment is a good place to just tell folks that I have asked LC to draft a bill that would expand the women's reproductive health rights that were given in House Bill 3391 to a fertility treatment array. And I've had some conversations with the chair on that. I'm very anxious for all of the healthcare community to weigh in on the impacts of that and the viability of doing that kind of thing, and I look forward to those conversations. So thank you.
Co-sponsoring that with Representative Howe. Any other comments? Representative Geyer.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had just wanted to ask a few questions of this panel originally, so I won't do that other than to thank you for your work, to say I think we have an incredible gem here that we may be underutilizing in Oregon since you do national work. In the mental health arena, I hear about Eddie and pre-manage all the time, what huge help this has been. And so my encouragement, because I can think of big picture things that I would love the help from OCHIN on, and I can also think of very specific things of the 50% of everyone on Medicaid, how many are pregnant and are getting dental care. You know, I can think of a lot of things. And so I just want to make sure that these two great entities are talking to each other. And so I was curious. I was going to ask about your business plan and how many of your projects are NIH or state or CCOs.
You can still ask them to respond to you privately.
Yes, so please do. I'm sure we'll have an opportunity for more conversations. But the bigger picture is just that I hope that these great assets that we have available to us are. So I'm delighted that you ended up on the same panel.
And I will apologize for being 1 minute late in adjournment. We're adjourned. And I will apologize for being 1 minute late.